Council, if you can grab your seat. We will begin. We've got a quorum. Good morning. It's Wednesday, May 15th, 2019. I will call the City Council briefing meeting to order. Welcome all, and it's a great day in Dallas. We're blessed. We will be given our invocation this morning, and then Mr. Narvaez will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Our invocator today, given the fact that today is actually Police Memorial Day, and this is National Police Week, is Raymond Butler of the senior pastor of Greater Mount Hebron Missionary Baptist Church for 35 years. Before I introduce him, I want to have a shout-out to two police officers I work with closely who are up in Washington with the Memorial Week. And is Andy Caceres and Tasha Tull, and they have a wonderful run with a marathon for with officers all across the United States honoring these folks. So I appreciate their effort in that. Pastor Butler is the lead chaplain for the Dallas Police Department, and he has spent 22 years not only with the Dallas Independent School District, but I think you said 19 or something like that, years with the DBD. He's got a Bachelor of Psychology from North Texas and a Bachelor's from DBU. He holds a Master's from Texas A&M, Commerce, and he's married to Yvonne and have two children, Brandon and Brandy. He's a face around City Hall, especially in times of tragedy. Thank you all. Thank you, Pastor Butler, for being here. All rise for the invocation.
Let us pray. Oh, gracious Father, we thank you so much for just allowing us to get up this morning and make our way to this place. We ask you, Lord, now that you would just direct our path and let everything be done in decent and in order. Help us to know, Lord, that we can't do nothing without you. But with you, Lord, we can do all things. We can learn to love one another. We can learn to how to get along together. We can learn how to walk in peace together. So, Father, we ask right now that as we look upon the hearts of all those bereaved families of our fallen officers, on our National Memorial Police Month, we cry to you, Lord, ask you for your divine help and your guidance. Let this be what you have it to be. In his precious name we pray. Amen.
We're going to have a couple of special presentations now, but I wanted everybody to understand the order of what we're going to do this morning. We have these special presentations. Then we're going to take our open microphone speakers. We will take up a few items for the voting agenda that have to do with the election. Then we are going to break into executive session, a closed session, where everybody will leave, because we need to have some information before our first item, which is item A on the Office of Homeless Solutions Strategy. So we will listen to everybody, vote, go into closed session, then we'll open it back up, and we'll take the briefing and comments and questions. So that'll happen here in about 25 minutes, I suspect. With that, Mr. Narvaez has a special presentation to begin with.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We can ask security to let the folks from Brother Bill's Helping Hand come in so that they can be part of the presentation, and then they'll be switching out with Mr. Atkins' community members once they're...
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Before I get started, I just wanted to give a shout out to Pastor Butler. He has been a long time pastor in West Dallas, and I just wanted to thank him for all the work he does as well in the community. He runs a crime watch on top of everything he does for the city of Dallas, and he's probably one of the few pastors I know out there that is out there collecting trash and picking it up, cleaning the streets himself personally, not just asking others to do it, but, you know, sets an example by doing it himself. So thank you for everything, Pastor Butler. Didn't intend for this morning to be all about District 6, but I did that last Wednesday, and I guess I'm doing it again this Wednesday. So we'll get started with this. Brother Bill's Helping Hand is an organization that has been in West Dallas for 75 years. It has a long, rich history of doing good works and helping those at their most need in the city of Dallas. And I just wanted to give them a special recognition. So thank you, Mayor, for doing this for us. And I'll go ahead and read it because I know we got a lot to do today. This is a special recognition. Whereas in 1939, Brother Bill Herod, born William Lee Herod, founded Eagle Ford Baptist Church, situated just below the levees of the Trinity River. And whereas in 1943, Brother Bill began meeting the needs of his neighbors in West Dallas who are hungry and underprivileged by providing canned foods from his cupboard. Brother Bill opened a closet in a warehouse to store dresses, suits, sweaters, and shoes for those in need. And whereas in 1961, his Helping Hand ministry became formally registered as Brother Bill's Helping Hand, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And whereas Brother Bill passed away in 1976, but his legacy has lived on through Brother Bill's Helping Hand's devoted service to the West Dallas community. And whereas in April 2012, Brother Bill's Helping Hand moved into its current location on Westmoreland, in the heart of West Dallas. Today, in the larger and more centralized location, Brother Bill's Helping Hand is changing more lives as it opens doors to serve neighbors in both West Dallas and Oak Cliff. And whereas 2 years ago on this date, Wesley Keyes became the fifth executive director of Brother Bill's Helping Hand. And whereas Brother Bill's Helping Hand annually reaches 6,000 individuals from over 1,500 households, representing 25% of the entire West Dallas population. And whereas the City of Dallas commends Brother Bill's Helping Hand for its dedication to impacting lives in West Dallas by meeting the physical and spiritual needs of our neighbors for over 75 years. Now, therefore, I, Michael S. Rawlings, Mayor of the City of Dallas, and on behalf of the Dallas City Council, on May 15, 2019, do hereby extend special recognition to Brother Bill's Helping Hand. If it's okay if I let our CEO, Mr. Keyes, say a few words. Today is actually his second year official anniversary of leading this wonderful organization. So it's not just our 75-year honoring, but also we're so excited you've been there these past 2 years, and we look forward to you being there many more, maybe 75 more for sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman, and thank you, City Council in general. Appreciate the work you guys do for our city. This is not about me. This is about 75 years of men and women who have come before me as I stand on the shoulders of giants doing the work that we've been called to do by God in West Dallas. I'm privileged and humbled to be a servant here in this city, and I couldn't do it without all these neighbors and all the staff that are here with me today. I want to say a special thank you to all of our West Dallas neighbors. Para nuestros vecinos, gracias por su presencia hoy con nosotros. Dios le bendiga para su servicio en la comunidad también. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Councilman. God bless you.
So if we could go ahead and take a quick picture so we can switch out to Mr. Atkins' group.
So we can all come in. We're going to take a fast picture. Here, you need to hold that.
Ms. Norvez, thank you. I've visited a couple of times, and it's a very inspirational place, you should be proud that it's part of a District 8. Mr. Callahan.
Yeah, I just want to, from a personal standpoint, my grandfather passed away in 1936, and our family on the mother's side relocated from Bossier Parish, Louisiana, and they moved to West Dallas in Eagle Ford, and they were actually beneficiaries of that program with Brother Bills in the early 1940s, and so that enabled them to get by. They lived in public housing just very briefly because my grandmother had five children, but my mother always spoke very highly of that program, so she'd be proud today.
Thank you. Great tradition. Mr. Atkins wants to recognize some folks from District 8.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, colleagues. It's been almost a year since we started our community office in District 8, and we just have a film just said thank you for your support. And also, TC, thank you for District 8. Joseph, would you do the video, please?
The coalition is something that's outside of the box. When Councilman Atkins showed and put this thing together, it was that shown that he was listening to all the residents, that he wanted them to be a part of what was happening in District 8, not just from downtown, but from the community.
Oh, I love the coalition. And the good thing about the coalition is it's building. And that's what we need to do. It's not just a coalition where we just meet and eat. We do, though. But we also actually build, too. And that's in economic development and co-violation. Whatever the need is in District 8, we're building on that through the coalition.
I think the coalition has been beneficial to District 8 in as much as we've come together as a family. We've come together as a strong community. We found that our similar problems, our strengths and weaknesses actually help each other. And so some of the information that one of us may not have been aware of.
I think the coalition has been beneficial by allowing us to target problems that we all share. Each neighborhood, if you talk with each other, you realize that the issues that you have are the same issues that other people have, whether they're within a mile radius of your neighborhood or a 5 or 10 mile radius.
Well, I think this is a fine coalition because it's bringing all of the community leaders together to work on certain issues that we have within the community. My issue that I work on is dealing with code and enforcing code, and also working with the different members of code from the city of Dallas, so therefore we can resolve some of the issues that we do have. And at this point, since the coalition have been a great part of this community, we have resolved a great many issues.
The coalition has been beneficial in District 8 because with a lot of people kind of giving their opinions, it helps to better the community than what it is. So somebody gives, like, let's say for example, what we talked about in there about the different, we talked about gangs and stuff today, right? So basically what it was, the gangs, everybody gives their opinion. They were talking about how they could better help themselves. And sometimes it's about how to better help the police improve to catch gang members.
Yes, it's very good. You learn a lot, meet new people in the different areas. It's just nice to have.
In your opinion, how has the coalition been beneficial to District 8?
Very beneficial because we know what each other are doing now.
Coalition.
the coalition was formed by two District 8 members, from what I was told. I believe it was Kalani Jackson and Gail Terrell. And their vision was to bring together members, community activists, leaders within the District 8 community so we could all come together and collaborate on different issues that might affect District 8.
In your opinion, how has the coalition been beneficial to District 8?
The coalition has been very beneficial to District 8 because I'm able to collaborate with like minds, other activists that have been fighting this good fight for a very long time. I think I'm one of the youngest members in there. Wanted to throw that in there a little bit.
The coalition was something that I felt that the southern sector of town, mostly District 8, was in dear need of. I had spoken with Councilman Atkins several times about the things in our area that the citizens are not pleased with. He contacted me back in August and asked if I would be interested in becoming a part of the coalition. I had no idea what was in store, but forming the coalition has been. I knew how large District 8 was, and I understood that if there was a problem in my community, it would probably be a problem in another community. I don't think that the people who live in this area of town have separate issues. Streets, code are some of the things that we all share.
The coalition is an organization that takes the community and we speak to each other, we share concerns, we share what works, what doesn't work, what we like and what we don't like, where we need help and where we have too much help.
Welcome to District 8 Community Office. We've been talking to many of the members of District 8 Coalition. I hope that this interview with different members of the coalition, different homeowners association, different crime watch association at the community office. This office was set up by the city council. I want to thank the Dallas City Council. I want to thank T.C. Brodnett. I also want to thank Mike Rollin, all my council members. This has been a great asset to our community. As you see, the members of the coalition have been the great asset of the city to talk to the city manager, the chief of police, the director of code, all of the different departments that come out to this community office to say, hey, you know what? City Hall now is in your community. This library was a black library, but point is, we turned some in black. That in the community is an asset now. It's a miniature city hall that in the community, and we do not have to go down to City Hall. City Hall has now come to our community. Again, I just want to thank the city council and the city manager and all the staff for coming out and sharing their experience and the needs and show that we are one city, north, south, east, west. We are making sacrifice. But one thing is, we are now believing in the city of Dallas. Now we are believing in the department. Now we are believing in that we are having the communication between the community and the city departments. Thank you very much.
With that, Mayor, I'm just going to call some names out that some of the members and give us a chance. We take a picture. Mr. Slaughter, Ms. Jackson, Ms. Armstrong, Ms. Robinson, Ms. Johnson, Clyde McDay, Ms. Spiller, Ms. Austin, Felicia Stewart, Gail Terrell, Glory Bunn, Strogan, Mr. Carter, Ms. Armstrong, Strogan, Lloyd Blair, Michael Smother, Nancy Armstrong, Odia Lee, and Ms. Owens. Will y'all come forward? And can we take a picture? Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you know it. You know it.
Ms. Johnson will take our morning speakers.
Thank you and good morning. We did have a couple of cancellations. Therefore, your first five registered speakers will be Robert Ceccarelli, Leo Cusimano, Laurie Sprouse, Norman Williams, and Kent Rathburn. I'll recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of the City Council. Any speaker making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks, or who becomes boisterous while addressing the City Council shall be removed from the room. Individuals are given 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice the time on the monitor in front of you. When your time is up, please stop. Address your comments to Mayor Rollins only. Also, if you have any handouts, go ahead and hand it to the officer to my right, as it will affect your speaking time. Your first speaker is Robert Ceccarelli.
Good morning, everybody. Remember John McCain did this? That's what I'm asking you about, this permanent supportive housing, the $20 million you just found out. This is the mayor and Larry James' idea of waiting 5 years down the road to build something which is a crisis right now, and people are dying on the streets, suffering crazy like you never seen before. I want you to go down to West End, take a field trip down there, and find out exactly what it's like down there. Okay, you can walk out all you want, all right? But I'm just saying to you is that if you do that, you'll see the homeless people, you'll put the biggest smiles on their face, okay? And that's what they need right now. They cannot wait 5 years. Remember the colleges, how that was a tragedy? I am just appalled that the mayor, Larry James, are in on this. I've asked the mayor to talk about more about permanent supportive housing at the library, but he continues to talk about 5 years down the road. Why do you want the homeless to suffer 5 years down the road? I mean, I am just sick and tired repeating myself all the time about this. I have the experience and the knowledge of homelessness. Take my word. Delay it, what you're doing to do the vote today, and that $20 million, it's going to waste it 5 years. That money needs to be right now, where they get off the streets. Salvation Army has a program of disability where you stay there and every day counts for being homeless and you don't get kicked out. That's what the money is needed for. That $20 million needs to be used as an emergency shelter where they stay there and don't get kicked out. It can work. That's what it's needed to be right now. I don't know what's going on with you all, man. Really. You should believe me. Look at me, everybody. Really, I'm very serious about this. And I'm just saying to you, like what I just said, go to the West End. Do a little field trip. They need your help. They're so much down on themselves. You put the biggest smile on your face. All of you together. The West End's only two blocks away. You make it look like it's the third world. And one more thing before I go. I'm still asking for the city council about this tape at the Omni that Mayor Rollins spoke during Christmas time. Dr. Daniels' office, County Commissioner Daniels, is asking for the tape. This tape will show the complete opposite direction the mayor did 8 years ago with the homeless. He wasn't optimistic at all with the homeless. He didn't have show any hope. All he said was, we're trying to do a better job. That's where he should have showed off about the 500 homeless people there. You know, it's like disrespect, really. That's like disrespect what Mayor Rollins did at the Omni. I don't get why I was there, but please, Mr. Thomas, I know, please get the tape. It was a tragedy what the mayor did. And please, delay this vote, okay? Please delay it about what you're doing today because they're going to kill you. It's 5 years down the road. They can't wait. They cannot wait 5 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Leo Cusimano.
Good morning. My name is Leo Cusimano. I'm the publisher and owner of Dallas Voice in Outnor, Texas. I live at 1619 Sylvan Avenue in Dallas. Dallas Voice is the premier media source for LGBT Texas, and we just celebrated our 35th anniversary of publishing in this week's issue. Outnor, Texas is the official LGBT visitor's guide for the city, LGBT defined as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. I'm here today in support of Visit Dallas to my organization, to the LGBT community, and for tourism in Dallas. The LGBT community here in Dallas is the fifth largest in the nation. In full disclosure, Dallas Voice and Outnor, Texas has a mutually beneficial relationship for the past 6 years. This unique partnership was developed after 5 years of work, after many years of working with Visit Dallas to market the city to the LGBT community nationally. This partnership helped create Outnor, Texas, which is the official LGBT visitor's guide for the community. This relationship helps save the city money from having to produce a visitor's guide and having to send team and representatives from the Bureau to some LGBT conferences around the country because we do that for them. We also help promote Dallas here at home and serve as an important resource. Our partnership is unique and considered a model for others in building relationships between visitor bureaus and the LGBT community and LGBT media. In December, Community Marketing, Inc., a San Francisco-based market research firm, produces the International LGBT Travel Symposium, invited us to speak at their conference and share our best practices. Visit Dallas is instrumental on other fronts as well. Understanding business and importance of diversity and inclusion, they helped fight the bathroom bill in last year's legislative session with the Texas Welcomes All campaign. They traveled to Austin alongside many other corporations. Visit Dallas worked passionately to help defeat this discriminatory bill. They understand the big picture. They understand the complexities of promoting Dallas to attract conventions, meetings, and events. They have a strategic, integrated approach to marketing this city, elevating our exposure through advertising, press tours, creating events to showcase the Dallas experience, and more. The Visit Dallas team has years of experience marketing this city and understands the importance of key indicators like diversity and inclusion. Again, they understand the big picture. Just look at the numbers. Dallas is the top visitor destination here in Texas. Dallas is also number six in terms of destinations in the country for meetings and events. Hotel revenue is up more than 8%. In 2018, and revenues of more than $3 billion. Hotel bookings skyrocketed to more than over $2 million in the past 15 years. The facts speak for themselves. The numbers tell a story and write a narrative that Dallas, Visit Dallas, has the experience, has the knowledge and vision, and holds the relationships to key organizations to effectively bring in business and elevate commerce into this city. Again, they understand the big picture.
Thank you.
Lori Sprouse.
Thank you, Mayor Rawlings, for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Visit Dallas. I'm Lori Sprouse, and I'm co-owner of Ultimate Ventures, a Dallas Destination Management Company, or DMC. We DMCs work with meetings and conventions coming into the Dallas-Fort Worth area, helping our clients with their transportation, events, and program logistics. We work with local vendors, caterers, decor companies, Florists. We employ 20 full-time and upwards of 150 part-time staff, and we are just one of many DMCs. and Visit Dallas is critical to our success. Ultimate Ventures is 26 years old, and we are a charter and continuous member of Visit Dallas. Thus, I've been through the and witnessed the history, which includes the highs of the 90s down to the rock bottom of about 15 years ago when Dallas had no convention center hotel. We were barely a top 20 destination, pretty much tier 2 or tier 3. The convention center was relatively empty with a lot of availability, and the CVB was in debt to millions of dollars and only booking about 500,000 room nights a year. But the worst was that Dallasites were our own worst enemy in telling their friends, why would you book a meeting or convention here? There's nothing to do here. Contrast that with now, when the Omni Hotel has been wildly successful and to the benefit of all of us local businesses, a total game changer. Visit Dallas became debt-free and now books 2.5 million room nights a year, a fivefold increase. And amazingly, Dallas was listed in 2018 by Steven as a top six, as top number six in visitor destinations. We are regularly competing and winning against Orlando, Las Vegas, and Chicago, and thanks to innovative Visit Dallas marketing and festivals and social media, Dallasites now think our city is cool and awesome. So thus, in 15 years, Visit Dallas has changed the entire perception, the desirability factor of Dallas, both locally, nationally, and globally. Please don't take this for granted. Top global companies like Toyota, Lexus, and Acura are proudly hosting events here that would never have happened 10 years ago. That's a result of Visit Dallas. In my segment of the industry, 10 short years ago, there were six or seven of us, and our clients affected about $250 million locally in economic impact. Now there are twice as many companies like mine, and we collectively, our clients, affect about $1 billion worth of local economic impact, and we just touch some of them. So what does that mean to Dallas? Jobs, jobs, jobs. It also means all kinds of tax revenue to hire more police and fill more potholes. But there's a terrible misperception among Dallas citizens that Dallas taxpayers are funding and wasting money on Visit Dallas. Nothing could be further from the truth, and yet few are standing up to correct the record. It is visitors and meetings and conventions participants and tourists that are staying in our hotels and whose hotel taxes are paying the funds for Visit Dallas, not Dallas taxpayers. And in fact, those visitors and Visit Dallas's successful marketing are saving Dallas taxpayers some $1,000 or more per person annually. So I beseech upon you to be properly informed, to recognize and support Visit Dallas for their unparalleled successes and positive impact on Dallas. And everyone in this room needs to do a better job of educating Dallas citizens about the benefits that this industry brings to the city. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Norman Williams.
Good morning. My name is Norman Williams. I'm here talking about 619 Woodbine. I bought the house like 5 years ago. It was in litigation. It took over a year to close on the property. At the time, the owner did tell me that during that process, there was a demolition order placed on the property. I had entered the largest project of my life. It was the apartment complex that you guys helped me out with, that LifeNet was the LifeNet was the tenant. And so I had a friend that said that he worked in the demolition department of the city, and he said that he would partner with me on this property. We started going to the demolition meetings. Every other week we would alternate on the demolition meetings. I was busy with the apartment. He was supposed to go to a meeting, and he missed the meeting, and they ordered the property to be demolished. He told me that 2 weeks later, when it was too late, because I had planned to just demolish it myself. It would have been a lot cheaper. And the property was demolished. The city charged me $23,000 for the demolition, and that demolition fee incurs ongoing, it has ongoing interest and fees added to it. And basically, my solution was to build on the property, but there's a 20-foot drop on the land, and the foundation alone would be over $40,000 to support something with a drop like that. So I'm here today to ask if I could either surrender the property or give it to one of these good nonprofit owners donate it to somebody, or because I can't afford that fee. So I would like to surrender the property because you guys are going to probably foreclose on it anyway, just down the line. So is there any way that I could?
Yeah, we'll have somebody. If you'll step back there, we'll have somebody come back and talk to you.
And one more thing I have. I know I have talked about my friend and kind of pointed the finger, but I have kept the taxes current and the mortgage current. So I have taken responsibility. Okay. So thank you.
Thank you. We'll have somebody come back and talk to you. Appreciate it.
Kent Rathbun.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Morning.
My name is Kent Rathbun, and I am a chef and restaurateur that has been working in Dallas since 1990. I opened my first restaurant, Abacus, in 1999, and I was asked to be on the board of then the Dallas Visitors and Convention Bureau. My position on that board was really to kind of help spread the word about Visit Dallas and the Convention Bureau in Dallas. Part of what my responsibilities were was to kind of spread the word throughout the country as I traveled, and also with delegations to New York, to Philadelphia, to Miami, different cities around the country, and just talk about the culinary scene in Dallas and what we're bringing to the city and the region. I want to say that I'm shocked that this is even a discussion, because I feel like as a business owner and a restaurateur and a chef, you know, we are afforded some beautiful visits. We have great conventions. The convention hotel has been a huge thing for all of us in this business, and I think that one of the things that I've learned over the time that I've been involved with the board and been involved with Visit Dallas is that the word is spreading throughout the country, and I think you can see that by the amount of people that are starting to come to Dallas, whether it's visit for just a weekend or for a major convention. In fact, last year we landed a big culinary competition, one of the largest in the world. It's going to bring thousands of people to the city. I don't think this would have happened without the efforts of Visit Dallas. And so as a restaurateur and chef, I'd just like to kind of make sure that you understand how important that these conventions are to the hospitality industry in the city, whether it's a hotel, a restaurant, shopping districts, the arts district. I mean, this is something that we've had to tout throughout the time that I've been around the board. You know, one of our discussions was always, you know, Dallas does not have Mickey Mouse. We don't have mountains and we don't have gambling, but we do have beautiful restaurants. We do have fantastic shopping. We got great hotels, and this is a great region because of DFW Airport. And so I think that the idea of us to take a look at you know, defunding this or changing it dramatically is really not a good thing long term. I think if this happens, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, we're all going to be looking at this going, well, why did we do this? Because we're going to see a fall in the visits. We're going to see a fall in the economic structure of the hospitality industry, because we get a lot of people through Visit Dallas. And I think the idea of this expanding the park at Clyde Warren Park is another really very, very big positive thing for the city. And Visit Dallas would be at the heart of that. And so I would ask you to reconsider anything that might change the budget or change the situation for Visit Dallas in the future, because I think it's a fantastic thing for our city. So thank you so much for letting me speak.
Thank you, Mr. Rathbun. We'll take the other speakers that signed up after the briefing this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This concludes your first 5 registered speakers. We'll now move to your voting agenda. Agenda item 1 is approval of minutes of the April 17, 2019 City Council meeting.
A motion and a second. Any discussion? Edits? All in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Agenda item 2 is consideration of appointments to boards and commissions. There are no boards and commission nominees for consideration at this meeting. Agenda item 3, receive the report of the Ad Hoc City Council Canvassing Committee and adopt a resolution and order accepting the Canvassing Committee's report, declaring the results of the May 4th, 2019 general election for members of the City Council.
Mr. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor, and bear with me. I have a lengthy bit of reading to do here, but the Ad Hoc Canvassing Committee, consisting of myself, Ricky D. Callahan, Mayor Pro Tem Casey Thomas II, Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Adam Medrano as alternate, and council members B. Adam McGee and Jennifer S. Gates were appointed February 27, 2019 to canvass the returns of the City Council general election held on Saturday, May 4, 2019 to elect 15 members to the City Council. The Ad Hoc Canvassing Committee met yesterday, May 13, 2019, to canvass the results of the Saturday, May 4, 2019 general election. On behalf of the Ad Hoc Canvassing Committee, I make the following report, a copy of which has been provided to each of you. Based upon the statement of returns provided by Dallas County for the City of Dallas general election held on Saturday, May 4, 2019, we find the following candidates received a majority of the votes cast by the qualified voters of the City of Dallas for the individual City Council places indicated. For City Council Place 1, Chad West was elected. For City Council Place 2, Adam Medrano was elected. For City Council Place 3, Casey Thomas II was elected. For City Council Place 5, Jaime Resendez was elected. For City Council Place 6, Omar Narvaez was elected. For City Council Place 8, Chanel Atkins was elected. For City Council Place 10, Adam McGee was elected. For City Council Place 11, Lee M. Kleinman was elected. For City Council Place 12, Kara Mendelson was elected. For City Council Place 13, Jennifer Stahlbeck Gates was elected. Candidates for the following City Council places did not receive sufficient votes to be elected. That's City Council Place 4, City Council Place 7, City Council Place 9, City Council Place 14, and also City Council Place 15 Mayor. These results, as provided by Dallas County, appear to be accurate, and the Ad Hoc Canvassing Committee recommends the City Council adopt a resolution accepting the report. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Do we have a second? Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion is carried.
Agenda items 4, 5, and 6 will be considered collectively. Agenda item 4 is an ordinance ordering a runoff election to be held in the City of Dallas on Saturday, June 8, 2019, for the purpose of electing members of the City Council to represent places 4, 7, 9, 14, and 15 Mayor, in which no candidate received a majority of the votes in the general election held Saturday, May 4, 2019. Agenda item 5 is a resolution authorizing an increase in the joint election agreement and election services contract between the City of Dallas, Dallas County, and various other jurisdictions within Dallas County for the conduct of a runoff election to be held Saturday, June 8, 2019, not to exceed $1,460,003.60 from $670,317.74 to $2,130,321.34. Agenda item 6 is a resolution authorizing the mayor to appoint an ad hoc City Council canvassing committee to review the returns of the Saturday, June 8, 2019 runoff election and submit a canvass report to the full City Council on Monday, June 17, 2019. The canvass committee selected are as follows: Councilmember Ricky D. Callahan as chair, Mayor Pro Tem Casey Thomas, member, Councilmember Adam McGee, member, Councilmember Jennifer S. Gates, member, and Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Adam Medrano, alternate member.
Thank you. I'm going to entertain a motion. A motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed? No one's opposed. Motion is carried.
Mr. Mayor, your briefings continue.
Thank you. It's this time now we're going to break into closed session, and we'll ask everyone to leave. And this should take probably 30 to 45 minutes, and then we'll come back and make sure we're going to take up the Office of Homeless Solutions and the city manager's proposed a consolidated plan in the morning. And then at 1 o'clock, we will then take up our report from the city auditor in regards in response to the Visit Dallas audit. We'll do that at 1. It is 9:56 a.m. on May 15th. The City Council briefing meeting will now go into closed session under Section 551.071 of the Texas Open Meetings Act to receive advice from and consult with the city attorney on the following matters described on today's agenda: 3 Expo Events, LLC, V. City of Dallas, Freddie Davenport, DBA, Jim's Car Wash et al., V. City of Dallas et al., and under Section 551 of the Texas Open Meetings Act to protect the city's negotiating position with respect to third parties and deliberate the purchase and exchange, lease, and appraised value of real property prior to public announcement of a project for potential Track 4 bond sites. Thank you. All right. Oh, wait. I need to read this. City Council briefing has completed its closed session under Section 551071 and under Section 551072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act. And at 10:55 on May 15, 2019, we've returned to open session. Ms. Hardy.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mic is yours.
Thank you, and good morning to Mayor and City Council. Staff are here today to bring to you two briefing sessions, both related to the Office of Homeless Solutions strategy to address homelessness here in Dallas. We will first start with the fourth track of the actual strategic plan, which is related to bond implementation. This is the $20 million. That was approved by our voters back in November of 2017. Ms. Hartman will rather go through the properties that have been selected, evaluated, and identified by staff, and we will welcome feedback and answer questions from the council. The second presentation is related to feedback that we received from City Council as it relates to our inclement weather shelter services. City Council asked us to return back to the Citizens Homelessness Commission to look at recommendations for defining what is considered inclement weather, how we will operationalize our shelter services during that time period, as well as recommendations for amending Chapter 51A of the Municipal Code to allow uses for faith-based partners. So we'll go through both of those presentations and entertain questions. I'll hand it over to Ms. Hartman.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Mayor Pro Tem has asked for me to give a very brief update on where we stand with the overall strategy. As Ms. Chandler Hardy mentioned, we're going to talk about Track 4 first, but just wanted to very briefly give that update. Track 1 was our pay-to-stay process, and we have 50 beds with the bridge. Today, as of today's date, we have 48 of the 50 beds utilized. This program was implemented in October, and it's been successful. We tend to have a 90% utilization rate. As of today, we have 48 out of 50 of the beds filled. This includes wraparound services and the case management to get them to their next step in housing. Track 2, you guys will recall that we have revised that and we are only focusing on inclement weather. That will be the second briefing that we'll go through today. Track 3 is our landlord subsidized leasing program. We had an RSCSP to award a administrative entity to manage the $1.3 million that council approved in the budget. We will be presenting to Human Social Needs on Monday to talk about that RSCSP, and we anticipate having the contract up for council approval on the June 26th agenda. And Track 4 is what we're going to go into right now. We are on slide 3 for the agenda. What we will go through is our bond investment strategy, our selection criteria, a review of city-owned proposed sites, and then we'll talk about staff's recommendation and for City Council consideration and end with next steps. Slide 4. Mayor Rawlins really said it best when he said that the answer to homelessness is a home. And that has been the mantra that the Office of Homeless Solutions has embraced. And that's really the lens that we look at when we embarked upon this process. What we are here to discuss today is how we can create affordable housing units for those experiencing homelessness. We are not here to talk about homeless shelters. We are not here to talk about homeless facilities. So I just really wanted to set the stage for that. And the key piece is that we're discussing homes, how we can really get those who are experiencing homelessness into sustainable housing. As a city, we truly cannot move the needle unless we tackle the issue of affordable housing. And I'm really excited to discuss this with you guys this morning. So with all that being said, let's talk about our investment strategy. So you'll notice that we have three major themes at the top of the slide. There's six total. I want to talk about the first three in tandem. So we have innovation, collaboration, and leverage. The bond is only $20 million. With that being said, we've embarked upon this process looking at this funding as being gap financing and seed money. We have to leverage private investment in order to accomplish our goal of creating 1,000 affordable housing units to serve those experiencing homelessness over the next 3 to 5 years. In order to leverage that money, we have to be innovative and we have to be collaborative. We have to be able to take these proposed sites and look to create catalytic and transformative developments through partnerships with partners who are closely aligned with their mission to perform this service. The next three on the screen are inclusion, accommodation, and alignment. So when we'll talk a little bit more about this in the next slides, but in order for these projects to be successful, we knew that we had to have sites that were located in high-quality areas that were near major transportation sectors, that were close to major employment centers, access to grocery stores, and with high quality of life related to parks, libraries, things of that nature. We are also looking to do projects that are mixed income and mixed use. So we're looking for that opportunity where we can really activate the neighborhood, where we can take these assets that are currently not in use or underutilized and really transform them into housing to serve those experiencing homelessness, but also be an asset to the community. So we are looking to do projects that are mixed income and mixed use. And the last piece is to really just be aligned with strategic city priorities and objectives. Slide 5, the bond selection criteria. So when we embarked upon this process of looking at sites, there are a couple of things that we really took into consideration. The first one is that the sites had to be available. I know that there's been a lot of questions about, can we use this specific facility? Can we use this building? If it's not available for sale or if the owner is not willing to go on those negotiations, it did not appear in our search. We also looked at projects or properties that were below $5 million in terms of acquisition cost. I mentioned earlier that we only have $20 million in the bond. So any funds that we would need for acquisition would come out of that $20 million. So we set a barrier of nothing more than $5 million. Market value analysis. So this is key, and this goes back to the alignment with the strategic city priorities. So when we reviewed city-owned properties, when we reviewed the list, we had a lot of properties that came up that were located in the southern sector and located in lower MBA areas. And that eliminated them from our search because we really wanted to find properties that were located in higher opportunity areas. Access to amenities. I already discussed this, but we really were looking for sites that were close to public transportation where they could get to major employment centers, hospitals, grocery stores, and where they had access to high-quality amenities. For the Office of Homeless Solutions site selection criteria, this was something that we also analyzed in our search. So you guys are aware that we brought before the site selection criteria through human and social needs, and this was for any supportive housing unit. And by supportive housing, what we mean is that these would be sites that would serve the homeless and they would have access to case management and services for them to be successful. So in any site that would be supportive housing, we had a set of criteria by which we reviewed those. So we took that into consideration as well. I will now discuss three city-owned properties. We are now on slide 7. The first one is 12,000 Greenville Avenue. It is located in Council District 10. The closest MVA is B. It is currently zoned mixed use, which means that we would not need a zoning change for this proposed site. It is currently vacant land. The proposed number of units for this site is 100. We would be able to go a little higher, but that was the starting point that we had. The estimated project cost would be $20 million, and that's estimating $200,000 per unit. The supportive housing site selection criteria you will see here is 19 out of the 48 that we were able to evaluate. And the proposed population that would be served at this site are families. Slide 8 is 2009 and 2011 North Haskell. This is located in Council District 14. The closest MVA is a C. It is currently zoned community retail, which means that it would require a zoning change. It is vacant land. The proposed number of units for both of these addresses together would be 8. And the development type that we are proposing is a residential duplex or a townhome style. The estimated project cost is $1.6 million, again using the same $200,000 per unit. The supportive housing criteria is 14 out of 48. And the proposed populations to be served at this site could be seniors, transitionally aged youth, which would be the 18 to 24 age range, or veterans. The last city-owned site on slide 9 is 1805 North Haskell Avenue. This is also in Council District 14, with the closest MVA as a C. The zoning is community retail, so it would require a zoning change. It is currently vacant land, and we would be able to create about 3 units of housing on the site. And again, it would be more of that residential duplex or townhome type of style. The estimated project cost is $200,000. The supportive housing site selection criteria is 15 out of 48. And the target population to be served at this site is, again, seniors, transitionally aged youth, or veterans. We are now on slide 10. So the Office of Homeless Solutions is interested in considering 2 publicly owned sites and 4 privately owned sites, and they were discussed earlier in closed executive session. These sites are located in 5 different city council districts. So I went through the properties, the 3 city-owned properties. We talked about the others in closed executive session. Now we'd like to go into discussion, the recommendation where we would like to receive your feedback. So the first option would to be an acquisition first concept. And this would be utilizing bond funds to secure all of the recommended sites. And then we would maximize the leverage opportunities through our private and philanthropic partners. Option 2 would be an all-in-one concept where we would pursue one site to invest the entire $20 million bond. There would be no assumption of private investment, and this would preferably be a city-owned site because that would allow us to not pay for acquisition. The third option would be strategic placement, where we would pursue a combination of city-owned and privately owned sites that would be distributed throughout the city. For all of the options, they would require the issuance of a request for developer interest in which we would qualify the developers, and then we would have a future RFP where they would submit proposals to be awarded funding. On slide 12 for next steps, again, we're here to receive direction from City Council on which options to pursue. We would then do the acquisition of the properties if necessary. And then the third major step would be the release for the request for developer interest. And again, this is that formal process by which we would qualify the developers. And then if they were qualified, they would submit to a future RFP or notice of funding availability by which they would include renderings of the property, specifications, they would have their sources and uses of funds, their development pro forma, their operating budget. We would then come back to City Council with term sheets for any recommended projects and qualified development teams for approval. That concludes the presentation on Track 4, and I'm
available for questions.
Thank you, Monica. Thank you for continuing to push each of these initiatives and bring it in front of us on this urgent issue that we have in Dallas. There'll be lots of questions and comments. I'm going to try to simplify one question and have you kind of just opine on it before we I open it up. It seems to me that with as much progress as we've made in locating sites, there's still a little information that's not there yet. And for us to choose one, two, or three, okay, you have to do this release for developer interest, okay, the RDI. And that one way you might consider, or maybe this is what you're trying to consider, is some algebra here where, what did you say, we need 1,000 units?
We need 1,000 units.
Okay, we need 1,000 units, and the three variables are how much money we can lever with our $20 million, zero or a bunch of money. The second is the geographic diversity or dispersion. Thank you. I know how to talk, but I forget every once in a while. Geographic dispersion, okay? And the third is how quick we can get something done. Mm-hmm. Speed, because we don't want Mr. Ceccarelli yelling at the next mayor, okay? You know, we want to get this done. And I think we all have a sense of and you have to kind of fill out the blanks for each of those things to say how many units we can get. So one approach is for you to go off and do that work, prioritize for us to get that how you would prioritize and then bring it back at some point after obviously we're going to talk about it, but is that kind of an approach you're thinking about doing?
Absolutely, and we've already started that pre-work looking at, okay, if we wanted to only consider shovel-ready projects, which projects do not require a zoning change, how many units do we think we'd be able to get from those specific sites? Correct.
Being shovel-ready, the money that's available for those projects, and then making sure we have dispersion throughout the whole.
Correct.
And different things will fall in ranks based on that. Okay, good. That's kind of where my head's at. Mr. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mayor, and thank you, Monica. I know this has been a difficult exercise, but you're up to the task. You're a bright light, and I really appreciate your work. So my thinking is a project in really each quadrant. I think a shared sacrifice, you know, to kind of move away from the NIMBYism, you know, not in my backyard. I think if we show that right up front, lay our cards on the table that we're willing to build in every quadrant, that we're going to have that shared sacrifice. And therefore, I think if we utilize approximately $5 million each of the 20 for each of those quadrants, that seems to be a mathematical good possibility. Also, ready-built properties, as the mayor was saying, you know, the speed at which we can get these built. It's great to use city-owned property, but in many cases, those properties simply are not ready, may not have the right zoning. They may need to be replatted. There may be other impediments there. There could be, you know, asbestos issues, or if there's any structures on these, and I don't know the answer yet. You know, there's lead-based paint. There's just a lot of things that you have to deal with. Also, illegal dumping, you know, is problematic on some of those. Power line issues and just narrowness of the lots and setbacks from those lots. There's a lot of things that the city you're going to have to do. And I think the more using property that are ready to go, even if they're in private hands, to me would be much more expeditious, you know, I think, going forward. Slide 14, if you just show that slide. I think actually it would be the one. I have different numbers.
12. Slide 12?
No, it's the one where you have the priorities, the six different.
Slide 5?
Yes, yeah. I'm sorry. Mine has different numbers in my Yeah, you just were on it. Go back to the six, the categories right there. I feel like I'm at an eye doctor.
Okay, here we go.
The investment strategy, I think this is just fantastic. One of the best slides I've seen since I've been here. It just really gets it right down to what we're trying to accomplish, you know, in all cases. You know, but I want to caution, you know, my colleagues and everybody listening that we've had really this bond campaign. This goes back to November of 2017. That's 18 months ago. So the plan to plan, or as Mark likes to say, getting ready to get ready. I'm sorry I had to steal that one from you. That's been kind of problematic throughout the city. But I would rather let us get moving forward on those that were most likely to build in four quadrants that don't need to be replanted, that already have zoning that we can work with. I think that is going to speed us along much more. As the mayor said, 1,000 units are needed. Now, how much money can we lever? Well, I'd like to see $5 million in each quadrant. And then the speed at which we build, I think, is really paramount, you know, to making a real difference, because we've had long enough. I've spent 6 years here, and we've talked about this every single day, it seems like. And it's just, to me, an embarrassment, and we all share that blame, and I certainly take my full share of that responsibility, having served in housing and economic development. It's hard stuff. I always tell everybody in the real estate business, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. And it's hard, and that's the reason we haven't got to it. But it's now time to just kind of put our pens down and grab our shovels and start getting something constructed that we can make a real difference. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Ms. McGee.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I spent the last couple of years, I guess, engaging in a lot of discussions around affordable housing, best strategies, best practices locally here, partners at every corner of the city, and national discussions with different housing events we are going to and studies, and everything that I've heard, or at least the place I am right now, directs back to a slide that looks just like that. It's innovation. It's looking at different housing opportunities that plugs in, and specifically your words here, leveraging private and city investment into projects that are good, high-quality projects that also provide affordable housing in high-impact, high-quality areas. I mean, that's what I believe our job is to look for. And so when I go through this presentation, first thing I notice is all these projects are not innovative, don't leverage city research, and at this point have no collaboration. They're all 100%, at least from what I can tell, 100% affordable projects. The number one project, the signature, the first one that we would put together, is in a place where directly across the street there's 252 Dallas Housing Authority units. Just down the way there's 228 more housing units, each property. There's one of the highest crime tag areas we have in our city. It's an area that we're struggling with right now to really kind of get some positive things in that area. And then when we look at potentially developers that could be interested in a project where they're going to construct what is proposed to be at least 100, we've heard it could be more units of affordable housing, the innovation around that I was told is that, but we're also going to attach to it a animal adoption from Dallas Animal Services to this project, which I'm not familiar with. We had some discussion yesterday. Maybe there's some out there, developers that are looking to come in and develop a piece of property that's between a water department facility structure and animal services. But that's not the ideal place to put housing for the people who, in my opinion, have the greatest opportunity for housing options. It causes me to lose faith in this process. I've been working with groups that are talking about much bigger bonds needed to provide funding to really meet the housing needs we have in this city. And if this is what we come back with as our idea around innovation, collaboration, there has not been collaboration. We've not talked. I mean, the history of this property alone is impacted as how it relates to our schools. And, I mean, they're right near here, right near these locations, and in a, far enough away from the direct issue, we have good DART land. There's land close to DART stations that could provide some innovation around how we tie housing into transportation, how we provide mixed income housing that people of all walks of life want to live there because it's a benefit. That's the kind of housing we need in the city. It's where everybody wants to live there, not creating projects or duplexes or housing units that are just affordable, that stigmatize people who are living in these spaces. This to me is a very disappointing presentation from a number of levels. And it causes me pause to feel like we've got the right thoughts going into what we're going to do with affordable housing in the city moving forward. We're not checking boxes here. I love the words that came out during the presentation. I love the words on the screen, but it's not what we're doing in practice in this. And so I'm, to the what you're asking for, I'm not supportive, and I'm even more concerned with the direction that we're going at this point, that I don't feel like we're looking at real innovative projects. We're not collaborating. We're not leveraging our resources around what I think really good opportunities are. I mean, bring us what we've been working on and talking about. I don't even know if left hand's talking to right hand. Economic development, we've been talking about an area even around Skillman and 635 where we've got potential for, like, youth sports amenities or esports amenities, other things like that, as part of a project that also has a large affordable component to it. That's innovation. That's something people want to go to that can help get people into good housing, but also mixed income housing that helps projects move forward. There are things out there. The first time I heard about this was 24 hours ago. That's just not good thinking. And so I'm interested in what we can do after this, but not where we are right now. Thanks, Mr. Mayor.
I'd like to be able to, if I can, Mr. Mayor, address some of the concepts. And thank you for your comments, Councilmember Magoo. I really wanted to set the stage that what we have for you today are the actual sites. I agree 100% with your comments regarding innovation, transformative, being catalytic. That would come in the next step through our RDI, our request for developer interest, and our notice of funding availability. So that will be where the development community will propose to us, once we make sites available, they will propose the project. So they will have the specifics related to the innovation. They will bring the collaboration with their partners, the development team, the property management team, the team that will be providing the supportive services. This will also be our opportunity for them to propose the total number of units, with it being, you know, mixed income. If there's a mixed use site, what would be the other types of commercial uses or, you know, retail in that site? And that would also be our opportunity where we really get to see that leverage. So as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, this is really intended to be seed money and gap financing. We 100% anticipate having our private partners and our philanthropic community, through fundraising efforts, through the Dallas Area Partnership and others, where we'll really be able to leverage the capital stack and to be able to do more. So I apologize if I wasn't clear that this is only what we were proposing. We were really trying to get at, these are sites that are available, and we want the development community to come back and show us what they could do on these sites.
Thank you. Mr. Atkins.
Thank you. We went out to the voters, and we got $20 million, and I want to keep this in perspective. We just got $20 million. We don't have $200 million. You're talking about 1,000 houses when you first came to me, you know. We just got 20. That's our budget, you know. I'm for the projects, and back in the 60s, there was many homeless, but there was a project who was part the solution. And when you see most of the project, it was built around mixed-use development. And we got to be around mixed-use development in order to have a better quality of life. I don't see in this proposal a timeline. We passed the bond in 2017, 18 months ago. Where are we today? What is my timeline? When do we build the first project? When was the first person will move into that project? I don't see that. We saying that if we're going to build something, It's going to be a 200 units or 20 units. The cost of $200,000 unit. What happened if the operator go broke? I mean, do the city rely on the private sector to bail them out? Do we got a reserve left? I need to see that. I'll usually get a term sheet. If we're really going to take care of the homeless and we got a $20 million budget, let's stick to the $20 million and we'll pray and hope the philanthropy will come in and give that money. But as we know, there's a whole lot of other nonprofits who is fighting for the same dollars. And since we have went out to the taxpayers and said, hey, we need you to put $20 million taxpayer money, it's up to us as a steward of us to make sure this is a good investment. Where do we invest that money? What district, what part of the city? And to see that without a timeline, a sheet to tell me when will we break ground, you know, we got to do the RDI, right? So walk me through a vision of the timeline. When would that first person move in?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thank you for your question. So as we previously discussed, once we have feedback on which sites to acquire, if we need to acquire them, that would be the first step in the timeline. We would go through the acquisition process. We would, again, that would include getting approval from City Council to acquire that site. After we acquired the site, then we would have this available in the request for developer interest. We actually have the bones of that ready to go. We're just waiting on the sites to be able to include. So once we have that, we'll put that out to the development community. We'll probably give about a 90-day time frame in terms of receiving the responses back. We'll go through the evaluation period, and then for the development teams that are qualified and selected for the specific sites, then we would come back to City Council with a term sheet that would have all the specifics, and in that term sheet, we would have the timeline for construction. Again, it's going to depend on the specific scale of the site, but typically we would estimate 12 to 18 months for construction. So in terms of the timeline from us starting the process until shovels are in the ground and someone is actually moving in, I would say we're pretty much at a 24-month time frame as of today's date.
So,
but again, it depends on if it's a smaller project or a larger project.
Well, so therefore, my term then would be up by then. So we're looking at 2 years. I mean, maybe 3 years before we see someone move in. And so that would be almost 5 years. From the start, the voters went and voted on something, it might be up to 5 years for someone to move in. You know, that is a problem to me. If we're really going to do something, we got to make sure that taxpayers who went and voted for the $20 million, they don't have to wait 5 years for someone to move in. So the homeless population is probably going to grow, and we're going to need more money. So I'll ask some TC, whatever, this timeline to me, you know, what we need to do, we need to get some shovel ready. We need the taxpayers and the people to say, are we really serious about this, or are we just playing around with it? And right now, I'm looking at 5 years. Time to vote for something before something built, before someone move in. That's 5 years. That's unacceptable. So we need to kind of cut it out. I mean, if we're really going to make sure the homeless is going to be taken care of, we're really going to be serious about it, we need to find a way to get them out of the street and back into shelter, back to the homeless.
Thank you for your comments. We agree with the urgency.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman. And definitely, I would agree. I think whether 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, that is a lengthy time frame. But I'd say, one, this is not the only part of our continuum when it comes to how we're addressing and dealing with homelessness as it relates to figuring out and finding ways, one, to shelter people. And I think as we talked about a lot earlier in this process, way back when, you know, part of our shelter capacity issue is that we've got folks and people in shelters that actually could be out in housing, but there are no other rooftops for them to be under. So we're trying to work all pieces of this continuum. And I would agree, the voters did ask for us to utilize this $20 million to figure out how we can successfully advance reducing homelessness. But I think even as discussed in the voting measure, it was really contended that this would be leveraging dollars, because I think even the committee understood $20 million wasn't going to go that far. And as we spent a lot of time out in the community with the philanthropic community talking about how we would hope they could align some of their missions with our efforts, I think we will hopefully be successful once we have a plan and we can get out there and do things. I would say this, when it comes to the unacceptability of bond funding, I think historically, I would argue we've all been a little frustrated, as I'm still trying to figure out how to spend 1988 bond funding and 2003 and 1995 or however many other years. So to talk about 5 years, I think this council has asked us to execute and move these dollars out within a five-year period, and we're trying to accommodate that. But I'd say this is a attempt to find a way to get us focused on, do we build some properties and have long-term city ownership in some cases and underlying land to ensure that we've got affordability. But to Mr. Magoo's question and point, EcoDev, housing, our real estate department, public works and all have really taken a close look and have been working with Mrs. Hartman and Nadia on understanding that this is a piece of our housing issue. And we're talking about ensuring that we've got funding in any project, whether, as Monica said, would be different capital stacks for this particular type of clientele, mixed in with other types of affordability ranges that we'd be looking at partnering in the capital stack to ensure the development in these high opportunity areas. I would just say another thing around just affordable housing in general. We've got a lot of challenges through historic and history when it comes to zoning and what's been zoned out in PDs and other things that make it not just hard to place this type of housing, but to actually do affordable housing, period. And so we've got those struggles that also add to the timeline. So we've got to continually work at trying to identify properties that we believe are suitable, not just for, I think, the homeless population, which obviously in many cases people don't really want to talk about that, but just affordability in general. So, again, I think the input today, and as the mayor said, will help us refine kind of how we go forward and bring some things that we can get to this council that might be acceptable to not just people around the horseshoe, but the broader communities that they represent. Thank you.
And I agree with that, but I also said, number one, when we went to the voters, we said we got $20 million. And it was not said match $190 million with $20 million. It did not say that. And we just got $20 million in the bank. I don't want to work with $20 million. I don't want to say, okay, I'm going to depend on this rich guy come in and give me $190 million. I want to work with what I got in the bank. And that's still with the bank, because that's all we got. And if there are some people out there listening to this and want to write some $1 million check, write the check today. Don't wait until we do something. And that's my frustration. You know, we talk about it, but do something about it. I know when the mayor put me on the part of the task force, the vice chair, the first thing we said, where the money going to come from? The money has not came in yet. So I'm begging and begging and pleading, write the check. Bring the money. Put the money where your mouth at. Thank you.
Thank you. Clarification that Mr. Atkins reminded me of. In the request for developer interest, if someone has an innovative idea that's not in one of these properties, are you going to be taking that too?
That is correct. Good. So we would have available sites, but it's also they can bring their own project.
Great. Thank you, Ms.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Monica and Nadia. I know this is challenging. This is not easy work. So. And I do, I think you're acknowledging that there is a kind of a disconnect between your strategies and then kind of the options that you've laid out today, because we don't know what those requests for proposals or for development ideas will be. And I think that's where we're all kind of hung up. But you want clarification and you've given us options. So I would start by, one, I think we need to recognize that this is permanent supportive housing. This is not affordable housing in the sense that we're trying to accomplish in just in mixed use. This is, people that have come from homeless environments, and it's probably really important that we have some wraparound services around this permanent supportive housing. So for that reason, I don't think the city should be just building those units and then us operating that. I mean, I think that's off the table. I don't think you're really looking at that directly, but I don't think that's the business we're good at doing. So that doesn't make sense to me. But I do think you have to look at, okay, when you're looking at partnering with groups or developers, I mean, and we have, the city needs to leverage kind of what we can leverage. And it might be land, it might be just gap financing, and it could be, you know, some kind of zoning. I mean, you know, we control a lot of zoning, and that could be the only barrier. So you kind of have to value those in a way when we put it out for the project. Because I think what the projects that you've laid out, if we try to do it on our own, we're looking at $200,000 a unit, I think is what these projects are. Well, I mean, we have a permanent supportive housing project in my district, St. Jude's, that was built. They did so. I think there was some benefit from the city, but it was, the whole capital stack was just over $5 million, and it was $50,000 a unit turnkey, 100 units. So if you look at that number of 50, then if we really want 1,000 units, we budgeted for $20 million. We've got $20,000 a unit. So, I mean, we could partner with somebody. You can give you $30,000, and then we're going to come up with that number. Just if that's all we do, we just give someone $30,000 a unit, and they provide everything else. Or is there a way to value the land? Okay, they could use city land. So then, you know, there's a value to that, and they're going to pay more. So I think we just need to be really flexible when we release the request for development interest, that to try to maximize achieving as close to those 1,000 units as possible. And I see we've got a lot of partners that are here listening intently that are in this business. And I think it's important that it is somebody is going to be able to benefit the residents in the way that they're going to be able to, you know, have the wraparound service necessary, and then make them, you know, and they can move on, and then we can bring in other people in these units to help in the future. So I think moving towards that real flexibility is important. I oppose when you look at your, I'm going to give you feedback now on the three options that you said. Acquisition first, I think no, because I think that could be very much like us going out and buying a bunch of library land and not being able to provide libraries. So I would not go out and acquire any land before we put out any of these. It's not RFP. What are you calling it? RDI. And then the all-in-one, pursue one site to invest. No, I don't think that's going to give us the kind of bang for our buck that we should be able to utilize, because we know people can do it for less than that. And, I mean, we've seen that happen. And then strategic placement, pursue in combination of city-owned or privately owned sites. I mean, I think that's just part of that RPI, is that you could, you know, use dollars of ours, you could use land of ours. If you've got challenges with a perfect site that has zoning, let's try to figure out if we could help you with that and move forward and move forward. So I think those are my points. Let's see, make sure I hit everything, the numbers. And I think lastly, then I would just point out, you know, when you go to this Proposition J, when you go to our own city website, this talk on the urgency, we said, you know, by this time we should have already spent $2 million. Well, I'm glad we haven't spent and wasted $2 million, but I think as soon as we can get this, the RPI out there and start looking at these proposals, or RDI, I'm sorry, then, you know, and kind of laying it out in a real flexible manner and seeing how many units we can really achieve, then we can, and some of those hopefully will be shovel ready. I mean, some projects that might be, we've got some partners right now that are working on projects that could just come in. If it's just the gap financing alone, we could open up and we can get things open within the next,
Thank you for your comment.
Can I
make a quick statement? I just want to clarify, Councilwoman Gates, thank you for your comments. Related to permanent supportive housing, because that's a term that's very specific, and that focuses on those that are chronically homeless, who have been homeless for an extended period of time or multiple times, and they also have a disabling condition. So this money can be used for permanent supportive housing, but our goal is supportive housing, because we also need housing for those that are in our shelter system that are not chronically homeless or have a disabling condition, they're economically homeless and they just can't afford something. So I just want to make that distinction that it's not the typical chronically homeless. It's anyone who is experiencing homelessness that can be served with these units.
And those people thank you. Move out and onto it.
Correct.
Thank you. Mr. Kingston.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mayor. I wanted to weigh in on the options and say that I really agree with Mr. Callahan here. The limited dollars we have mean that we absolutely have to go with option three and that we need to have a focus on adaptive reuse. In this environment, new construction is prohibitively expensive. I see our Salvation Army friends back there with their daunting task of raising the money that they're going to need for their new facility. We should look for stuff that can be reused. I also want to bring up another site that has been considered before, and to echo Mr. McGue's concerns about creativity, I brought a developer to the table and a site that is city-owned with a proposal to mix permanent supportive housing with market rate housing, which is something that can be done. And the reason I say it can be done is because a private developer said it could be done. That's not just me making that up. I believe it has been successfully done in other markets. And that site is the city's vacant lot by Sammy's Barbecue on the Maple Ruth Connector. Everybody in town has driven by this site a million times. It's owned by DWU. We need part of the site, a small amount of the site, as an access point for the Mill Creek Tunnel. The rest of the site should serve the city's purpose, whether it is housing. I mean, when I'm telling you that I've got an MVA-ready site that is, the MVA scores around there are off the charts. This is the definition of high-opportunity area. It is walking distance to transit. It is walking distance to education. And it is walking distance to some of the highest-paying jobs in the city. We need more creativity around sites like that. I mean, the message that came back to the developer was, you know, 5 years from now, DWU will tell us how much of the site will allow you to use. Come on. I mean, it is a monster site. We only need a small part of it for access. I feel like it was a missed opportunity. Let's put it that way. So I see today as staff quite rightly being very gingerly about talking about where we place these services and these types of housing. Mm-hmm. I am enormously encouraged from what I've heard from my colleagues without revealing anything they said in executive session that I think it is fair to say that this council has a very open mind about siting various types of supportive housing and other homeless services around the city, which is something we've been asking for a while. And I'm not hearing people say not in my backyard. I'm kind of hearing the opposite. So hopefully that is an encouragement to you all. It's nice for you to test these sites with us to make sure that they're appropriate. The ones in my district that you've proposed are definitely appropriate. Don't worry about it. That it'll be fine. But I think I echo part of Mr. McGue's concerns in saying that now that we've given you this encouragement that you're on the right track, let's start seeing those creative solutions. And the thing that I would also caution about options one and two is that we're experiencing a spike in homelessness in a robust economic environment. And relying on the private sector to fund maintenance and operations of homeless services in what is almost certain to be a down economy within the next couple of years, I think is exceptionally dangerous. We also don't know what's going to happen to the homeless population during that period, but it probably isn't good. So I think we absolutely have to, as Mr. Broadneck said when he first came in here, if this is a city problem, then it needs a city solution. And we love our private partners. I'm so excited about the Salvation Army's project. But I think we have to plan responsibly as though there is no cavalry coming. because that's frequently where we find ourselves in the city of Dallas. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas.
Hey, Mr. Mayor. First, I want to commend Monica and Nadia for your efforts to put together a comprehensive plan to address homelessness. When you established, Mr. Broadnax, the Office of Homeless Solutions, I think it spoke for what you're there for, to provide solutions to homelessness. So when we look at the first track, and I'm going to get to where we are, I think it was some innovation involved in seeing how we could address and create more opportunities and more space for individuals who need to get off the street. I can give a personal story. I have a relative who fell right into this situation, who was homeless and needed the type of assistance offered at Track 1. And that assistance was provided because Track 1 was available. And so I want to commend you, first and foremost, on that. Being chair of the Human and Social Needs Committee and those who serve on the committee, we've been looking at this for quite a while. Every component of this, track 1, 2, 3, and now we're having extensive discussion on 4. My question is, as you began having conversations, I alluded to the breakfast that was hosted with a lot of our partners, what has been some of the challenge, and what are they telling you they need from us in order for them to come to the table with matching dollars or dollars that will, we talked about the $20 million and potentially up to $200 million from our partners. What are they saying that they need from us in order for them to ante up?
Thank you for that comment, Mayor Pro Tem. Mm-hmm. So as we've had these conversations, what has been expressed to us is that they are just waiting on the sites to be available. We've had an overwhelming response where our partners have said we are ready to do something. Several of our philanthropic partners actually fund projects in other cities because the city does not have properties available yet for a plan. So the feedback that we have received is that they do want to support services for those that are experiencing homelessness. They do not want to continue funding shelters. They want to fund the long-term solution, which is the creation of housing units, and they are ready to go.
Well, if that's true, then colleagues, it sounds like they're waiting on us. Having a list of these sites, I think, is that critical step that's necessary to invite them to do exactly what they're saying. They're saying they're willing to put their money where their mouth is when we provide a list of sites. So the ball sounds like it's in our court. I can understand, you know, those who have some concerns with some of the locations that have been suggested. But if there are other locations that you personally know of, let's give a staff. Let's make sure that they have that information, because it makes no sense for us to have approved the citizens, the residents, have voted to approve this specifically, $20 million for this purpose, and the holdup be those who are our partners willing to put money on the table. And that's a commitment from what I'm hearing you say, Monica. They're just waiting on us to provide them a list of locations. So, colleagues, if that's the case, let's do what we need to do, and let's put the ball back in their court. Thank you, Monica.
Thank you, Mr. Clayton.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. thank you for your presentation. You know, one thing that I think is hard in this discussion, and Mr. Thomas kind of made the point, is I've sat in some of these meetings, and they are waiting on us. And what ends up happening is, because this becomes a political issue too, and everybody wants to say what they don't like, and it's SimCity, and just go create the new way of doing it, and there are options in front of us. I do appreciate what Mr. Kingston said, because I think it's easy to say no, and I appreciate the fact that he gave an example of something that we're not considering today that we might be able to do. May I address Mr. Kingston?
Yes, please.
Mr. Kingston, when you were talking about the site over by the Fed, and you had taken it and you had brought in the developer, how far did he get up the ladder? Was it just was it kind of middle-level staff, or is that something that could have been on this sheet and just the left hand wasn't talking to the right hand? Sorry.
Mr. Narvaez, jump off.
Thanks, Mr. Narvaez. I don't think I've got a very complete answer for you, Mr. Clayton. It's a great question. I know that there was a meeting that involved Homeless Solutions and DWU, but I would defer to the manager to explain why my great idea got shot down.
Mr. City Manager, why did his great idea get shot down?
You know, I think the discussion did evolve. I remember the conversation. I saw some very flattering communication about the particular site and our unwillingness to, I think, move off of the concern that DWU, until they had completed their project, did not want to risk, I think, turning over the land to private development. And so I think there's been a history with this project and the property that's long and lengthy, and so I'd have to revisit it with our team if, in fact, it is the desire of council for us to really go in and look at it a little differently and just understand the risk potentially of moving forward with carving off certain pieces of the property and then be in a position where we might have to utilize and or come back and figure out how we got it back. And so I think that's the challenge. Gotcha. It's chicken and egg, and it's the timeliness. And I think we've waited a long time for these drainage projects to happen there, and it's finally happening. And so I think that's really been the conundrum.
Gotcha. Thank you. Here's the reason I asked the question. I think one of the biggest problems that I think you guys have in doing this is you're on the island. And I think from a collaboration standpoint, it is really difficult using that particular example. You know, you're having to go out internally, and I think Mr. Narvaez made the point earlier about maybe getting some bench strength to help you, you know, professionals who are in the field who can look at all the listing services. You're having to do this where you're basically kind of driving around and winging it, and I think that's unfair to you. I think that's something that we need to bulk up quickly, because I do believe, I think to Mr. McGue's point, and I had told you all the other day, I think you guys made a sincere attempt of, we got to put 1,000 homes, and we only have a certain amount of land, and some of it we own. But to, I think Mr. McGue's rightful point, don't put situations of challenge in an area that's already challenged. And I think that's hard, but you have an area like what Mr. Kingston mentioned that is exactly what I think our all collective goal would be, which is don't marginalize people more, but put people in up to a better stead. And so I think I would maybe ask you, Mr. City Manager, if you can maybe just kind of leader this up at a senior level. I think they need help on that, and that's not their fault. I just think we need more eyes on the problem in that one respect. To get the 1,000 homes in today's dollars, what do you is the number still roughly $200 million, do you think?
That is a number that we're estimating, again, to a couple points that we heard earlier. If we were to focus on adaptive reuse and rehabilitation, depending on, again, what's in those specific sites, if they had any environmental concerns, in general, it's a little bit cheaper. If we're looking at vacant sites where we have to build from the ground up, then it is more expensive. So that's where we got that $200,000 per unit was, you know, new construction, and that would put the amount at about $200 million.
The only point I would maybe differ a little bit with Mr. Kingston and Mr. Callahan, or at least add on to, is the fact that whatever that number is, so if you do pure adaptive reuse, and let's say it's $150 million, whatever the number, $200 million, but if you had to build new, let's say that's a quarter billion, big quarter million would be better, but either way, we only have $20 million, so whatever that nut is, we're not going to be a part of that anyway. So I guess my question would be, of these three options, from what you guys are seeing as best practices in other municipalities, and you had our 100% agreement, what do y'all want to do? What in a perfect world, what is your recommendation as the people who are going to implement this?
Thank you for that question. So our recommendation would be looking at multiple sites where we get to leverage private investment. When you look at best practices across the country, Councilmember Magoo talked about earlier, you're really looking at mixed income type development. So we would be able to utilize the bond money to fund units for those experiencing homelessness, but it would be part of a larger project where they would have access to all other city incentives plus what's out there, private and philanthropic.
So that's option three?
Correct.
Gotcha. I'll just end with this. I would hope what comes out of this briefing today is if what we need to do is tweak sites, that we give you direction on that. And if we can, Mr. City Manager, you know, to the point, if we can just revisit all of our properties, because I know there's something in D Magazine about, you know, sale of land in Southern Dallas, and I don't know, I didn't hardly read the article, but I feel like there may be more sites that y'all aren't aware of that are either being held in the closet by different departments for logical reasons and or in land banks and just different things, and I feel like you guys don't have enough help with that. But the other thing, what I would hope we would come out to today is to say, look, go that direction, because I've been in two meetings, I know one with Mr. Thomas, where they've said, look, just give us a direction, but we're like a drunk on a pogo stick, and we just – I can't tell them what our direction is. And they're saying, we will give you money, but you got to tell us where, why, and how much. And we have got to come out of this today and give them a where, how much, and why, or we're just going to be in the same boat two or three years from now. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Ms. Kleiman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And again, Monica and Nadia, thank you very much for working on this very, very challenging situation. I do have a couple of questions with regards to location. How do we know where homeless people want to live?
Great question. So when you talk to them, most of them will state that they want to stay someplace close to wherever their network is. So if they're up in the northern part of our city, they would love to have a shelter or homes that they could afford up in that area. They need to be close. Transportation is usually one of the largest barriers because they need to be able to get to employment. And oftentimes where employment is, it's not where they can find affordable housing. So there's a disconnect there. And then they want all the other amenities that everyone else wants to be able to, you know, raise families and do well. So all the things that we talked about in terms of being located close to a grocery store, have access to get to one where it's a full-scale grocery store where they can get healthy produce and meat. They also want to be located near good schools if they have children in school. They also would like to have access to libraries and parks and things of that nature.
So is it reasonable to assume that where homeless people are right now is close to generally where they want to live? I mean, if we kind of overlaid a map of these locations with a map of where there's existing homeless populations?
I think that would be a fair assumption. Oftentimes what we see is a lot of the homeless will be, if they're unsheltered, they're near shelter services so that they can get to, you know, those services quickly. But with our teams that are out doing outreach, we also come across a lot of individuals and families that are not near shelters, but they're in their comfort level. They're in their comfort zone near, you know, family and friends, church, things of that nature.
Okay, so I think that maybe as we pursue this exercise further, because I know we have maps of where the encampments are, the larger, but maybe even some more ideas about when we're looking at sites, that can actually, for example, really help a population that's already located in that area. The second thing is other city sites. I very much appreciate that you guys came up with three sites, but a few years ago we had Eric Thompson in here testify that the city owns over 4,000 properties in the city of Dallas. And I just can't imagine that even half of those properties have some city employee going to them on a regular basis to provide some city service. You know, I've always advocated for getting more productive use out of the government-owned property, which y'all have done with some of the Dallas sites and some other publicly owned sites. But we are like one of the biggest landowners in the city of Dallas. And we really do need to look at sites more than, and that kind of upset me when I hear you, when we asked how did you find these sites, is like driving around. That sounds so unscientific. I'm sorry. You know, we have 385 square miles of this in this city, and we're driving around looking for vacant lots. There's got to be a better way to do it. And I think certainly one way to do it is literally sit down with a inventory list of city-owned properties, and even through a process of elimination, I got to believe there's hundreds worth looking at. So it looks like you're trying to say something, so please.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate your support and the question regarding the process by which we identified sites. And so even prior to Ms. Hartman's arrival here at the city, we did connect with our real estate division. We connected with Mr. Thompson and his staff and received that inventory of city-owned sites, all sites, regardless of size, regardless of location. We additionally looked at the inventory that's included as part of Mr. Noguera's land bank, all sites, regardless of the location. When we looked at those sites, particularly in the land bank, the majority of them are zoned single family, and they're located in areas that are ranked lower in terms of the NVA rating scale, and clustered mostly in the southern sectors of the city. As it relates to our entire real estate inventory, we narrowed those sites down to those sites that were at least 10,000 square feet and larger, sites that are not located in the floodplain, sites that are not located in areas that are rated lower on the MVA. After we did those, the shakeout of that, we came out with about 353 properties total that kind of met that general criteria. We went and looked at those sites. That's where the driving tours kind of came into play. We do welcome the support of, as one mentioned, a broker to help us with identifying more sites, particularly private sites. But in terms of the city-owned land, we do have quite a bit. But when we're looking at the criteria that was laid out by the Citizens Homelessness Commission in terms of areas we should be looking at, as well as what's contained within the MVA and our overall housing strategy and how we place housing, the number came out to be quite slim and narrow.
Right.
Well, in terms of what we could look at and recommend.
I appreciate that y'all managed to look at the whole inventory and kind of narrow it down to 350 suspects, maybe.
Right.
Suspect sites. And then, but getting from 350 to three actual prospect sites seemed like there may be a few more. Because I would much prefer, and to me it seems like we're using leverage, if we use city-owned property already, which means we can put more money into the investment in the improvements. Did we look at any existing – I know this sounds contradictory because I prefer that we use public land, but with that being said, do we look at any existing just apartment complexes or apartment sites so we didn't have to have all that construction cost?
We did. So as we were being very strategic in areas of town where we're looking that were higher opportunity, that's where we were out and about trying to see what was available and looking at any existing. We actually approached, you know, certain ones, and unfortunately at this time there wasn't any available. We know that it's a moving target, so it's something that we're continuously just trying to have, you know, our ear to the ground to see what's available.
I guess the question of availability, I'm not a real estate agent, but it's kind of my understanding that especially in commercial real estate, it's always available. It's just a matter of price.
Correct.
And so it seems like there are a lot of apartment properties in the city that potentially could serve this purpose. And also with regards to the mixed income component to it, it seems like we continue to provide money for affordability, but doesn't seem like we really have many requirements, for example, with regards to housing homeless in that affordability component. So, for example, we discussed the other day all these LIHTC rules and these scoring criteria and things like that. I mean, would we even have the ability to put in our scoring criteria for LIHTC, the ability to say you're going to have to, you know, even if it's just 1% for our homeless folks, it seems like we could pick up a lot of opportunities there.
Thank you for that feedback. We've actually been engaged with the housing department in what they're doing with LIHTC to make sure that we are involved in that conversation. Also just wanted to mention related to the apartment complexes and what's available. There was more, but again, we looked at anything. It had to be less than $5 million just because we only had the $20 million to work with. So that was also, a little bit of a challenge
as well. That may be, was that a criteria we put, ask you guys, or is that a self-imposed criteria?
That was the self-imposed criteria because we only have $20 million.
I think sometimes when you look at apartment complex, you kind of look at it all-in-one. You got a piece of property as well as the improvements are already on there. So maybe the number could be bigger. The last thing I'd like to mention of these options, while option two may not be the most ideal, it seems like it's the quickest path of these options to getting some, a fair number, 100 units on the ground. So I'm interested in that. Option three, I absolutely pursue, but I just think it's going to take more time. But I really continue to pursue city-owned sites. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a process check. It's probably 6 p.m. We've had 3 people that have not spoken yet and a few people that want to do second rounds. Just want to let everybody know that. Mr. Felder.
Yes. So I'd like to thank both of you for your presentation. You have a very tough assignment, which is why I think it's taking you considerable time. First thing I want to say is that biblically speaking, Mark 4:14-7, it says the poor will always be with you. And so no matter what we do, there's always going to be poor with us. I heard a lot of conversation and a lot of points made. First thing I want to say is that any surplus city property buildings are obviously undesirable. And anything that's built before 1978 will have lead-based paint and asbestos. And so you're going to have to spend an extensive amount of money to remediate the lead-based paint and the asbestos. Is there someone from real estate here?
Yeah. Good afternoon. Chris Wecker, Director of Sustainable Development and Construction.
Yes. Can you talk about some of the buildings that you have available that would meet some of the criteria for homelessness to, redevelop or retrofit for homeless people?
I'm not aware of any buildings that we currently have that are vacant of city staff that are appropriate for that use. We have funneled our list through the Office of Homeless Solutions as well as all the other city departments for potential use by the city, and they have not identified any.
So that answers that question. The second thing is, I do think that you possibly have someone on staff, maybe several real estate brokers on staff, that can assist in locating properties throughout the city. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I'll also point out that we are in the process of contracting with a brokerage firm to help us in those matters as well.
Well, why would you need to hire a brokerage firm when you have several on staff that are being paid by the city? It'd be a cost savings by using somebody already being paid.
It would only be used on an as-needed basis. Simply, we don't have the number of resources we need to keep up with the demand for acquiring, leasing properties, renting properties, et cetera. So this would just be on an as-needed basis whenever we have too much work to do.
Well, the concern that I hear from my colleagues is time. And so to have to vet a real estate broker and negotiate a contract or something like that, can we just temporarily bypass that and use the brokers that you have on staff that are already being paid?
We are currently doing that work. This would simply be a supplement to that. Okay. It is already through the procurement process. We're just waiting on final contract negotiations.
Okay. Thank you. So I think that may have addressed some of the objections and concerns that I hear from some of my colleagues. We do have people on staff that can assist the Office of Homeless Solutions to help you work to find properties. The properties, you've heard from the director, there are no properties that are available in inventory that can be utilized for this process. So we have to use a shotgun approach. We can't use a rifle approach. And I think that's what you guys have done, use the shotgun approach, the different options that you have to see what it is we can do to address this issue. The other point that I hear is that, you know, the amount of time that it's going to take if you build from the ground up. I believe we just passed a resolution for the Salvation Army, and I think that's going to take 3 to 4 years for that to be built. It takes time. You know, it takes time. If you're going to build from the ground up, it's going to take time. We don't have the city assets to do what we want to do. And so we have to keep that option open to be able to build something from the ground up. So you need that shotgun approach, and you are on the right track. I do believe that you have a monumental task. Not only do you have to find several options, you have to try to convince 15 different mindsets around the horseshoe that this is the right thing to do, and you're on the right path. And so let me just say this, be encouraged. You're doing the right thing. You're on the right path. Now, I will offer some constructive criticism, and the constructive criticism would be, as you're coming up with your options, meet more frequently with the council members so that they know what you're thinking, so that we don't get to this point and then you cold water is thrown on your results. But again, I think that you're on the right path, and be encouraged.
Mr. Griggs.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you for the presentation on Track 4. An important issue that I think Councilmember Callahan and Councilmember Kingston touched on is feasibility. With whatever we pick, I want to make sure we've got the money to complete it, and I would just compare it to the approach that was taken over a decade ago with the City of Dallas library system, where the City of Dallas went out and used a large sum of bond money to acquire various vacant tracts of land and other pieces of land throughout the city, and then didn't have enough money to follow through building all the libraries that we promised people. So feasibility is very important to me. Also, on the front end of this, I think we need to look at, for the lack of a better word, enticements, kind of with the Salvation Army case and looking at the surrounding neighborhood. We set a precedent where, although it had nothing to do with the Salvation Army case and everything to do with the Salvation Army case, we set up a neighborhood empowerment zone for the area around the proposed Salvation Army site. So I would like us to look at the front end on what kinds of programs, tools, or strategies could be used around these sites, whether it's amenities that the neighborhoods may need or the businesses may need, or other types of economic development or zoning entitlements for the surrounding area, to help make these projects a success.
Thank you. I would like to mention that in our request for developer interest, we do talk about all of the full suite of incentives that would be available.
Thank you.
Yeah. I would suggest, you know, not just for the developers, but for the surrounding area too. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Narvaez has not spoken.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. First, thank you for bringing this. I know this is a daunting task. I like the sites. I like that it's spread out. I will definitely recommend, let's look at a broker. I think our city manager mentioned they're going to try to get y'all some help in that respect, because this isn't something that's going away. You all said, I think, 1,000 units we need, like yesterday, and and we're talking here maybe 200 units. So we've got to look at that. I think site number 6, where the difference between 4 units and 40 units, we definitely need to go to the 40 units. There's already an apartment complex next door for senior citizens, and I think this would be a perfect complement to have 40 units there as well.
I think that we have to get an ROI for the taxpayers that approved the $20 million bond, and they want to see progress, and the vast majority, they want to see progress again yesterday. And I know y'all are working as fast as you can, and it takes time to build. It takes time to acquire. It takes time to locate. But I think that, you know, just looking at the one where the abandoned facility that's up in far north Dallas, that could be repurposed quickly, I think that's a great win. I think that's what Mr. Kleinman was kind of referring to, is finding a space that's already ready to go that maybe just takes a couple million dollars to rehab, and boom, we're opening the doors, and, you know, 20, 40, 50 families, seniors, whomever those folks are ready to go. So we need to look at density. I definitely love the idea of, you know, 4Zs and 8Zs here and there, which hopefully we can mix in, but kind of like our housing crisis that we have in the city where we're 20,000 units short, our own housing department has said that we're not going to get out of this, you know, building only single-family homes. So that might be something that we can look at is, you know, can we on these pieces of land, you know, we're not going to build 200-unit apartment complexes every time, but, you know, where maybe we can put four single families, could we maybe put two fourplexes and get 8 units instead of 4 units? Whatever we can do to add just a little bit of extra density will help us get there a little bit faster. Other than that, I think, you know, we're on the right track. Y'all brought us some options. I believe the Citizens Homeless Commission as well said these are some options, and y'all are bringing those to us. They're our advisors, and I think that we should be looking at them. I think we need to do all three, but just portions of all three. How do we make them? I think we've got to figure out where's that the lowest hanging fruit that we can get in, get somebody fat, you know, get folks in there as quickly as possible. As far as the Salvation Army project, that will have 100 units of permanent housing, but we are talking 4, 5, maybe 6 years from now before that goes in there. So I think my colleague, Mr. Kingston, mentioned that, you know, we've got to act like, let's act like we're not going to get those 100 units, because what if the Salvation Army can't raise all the money they need to get to that final phase of the permanency? We still have to figure out those 100 units. So let's figure them out. Quick question. How many people are in line that have been living while homeless that are ready to go? And because yesterday you mentioned to me, and I just wanted to hear the number for the public, how many people are in line already for this type of housing?
So we estimate that we have about 800 people on the housing priority list that are ready to move from the shelter out into some supportive permanent housing.
So 800 right there. So that's, you know, that's a big number. And I mean, that's why we need the 1,000 units. Is that where y'all get that 1,000-unit estimate from?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then how many are in line just for regular, like, vouchers that in hand ready to go as well? I think you mentioned a different number yesterday as well, in the 2,000 range or something like that.
So in our existing shelter system, we have about 2,000 people in the emergency shelter system.
Gotcha.
Yes.
So we have 2,000.
Some would have vouchers, but not all.
Not some will, but 800 we out of those 2,000 are ready?
Correct.
So in that 800 is sitting in our emergency shelter space. Is that accurate?
I think that would be accurate to state.
So if we can get those 800 folks into permanent supportive housing, we now have 800 open emergency shelter beds?
Correct.
So that would help the folks that are on the streets and that are in desperate need of this help that we just don't have
Absolutely.
Space for? Okay, awesome. And that I think that's why we've got to move as quickly as we can on this. I think this is the item that causes the bottleneck down on the emergency shelter side. And I'm sure all of our emergency shelter folks are also in desperate need of help, of us helping them and them partnering with us to find space, because they have, I'm sure, a list that we don't even know of people that need the emergency shelter space. I hate to see how big that number is. But overall, thank you for this. I think we're in the right direction, and I hope that we can move forward with, you know, all of this, but at least some of it, so we can help our most vulnerable population. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Second round, Mr. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. And I like the idea also of repurposing. I think it makes a lot of sense that we can just take a property and
and provide some enhancements and get it out and operational quickly. The idea of $200,000 per unit just makes me want to fall out of my chair when we're doing these kinds of projects, especially if we're looking at low or no-cost land. And I just, candidly, I don't think it's responsible. I think we need to re-pencil that. I think we can do a bit better on that, even with the environment that we're dealing with in Dallas. And that, the object is not to enrich any developer or any organization, but to get this very important housing on stream. We have a number of entitlements, obviously, through the city that we can deploy, whether it be tax abatements or grants, or we can certainly leverage nonprofit dollars, which we've talked about, also waiving building permit fees and some of those other things. And I would just echo again, if we've got 4,000 properties, let's reevaluate those and build a decision tree matrix to assemble, you know, which ones are ready, build land parcels. The Office of Homeless Solutions, in my view, y'all should put out an advertisement to the effect and be very clear that here's our goal. We want to build up to 1,000 units. We need X acres, you know, minimum, you know, just kind of calling all developers, investors, and interested parties. That just stipulate that we're looking for, like, multifamily, mixed-use, townhome, duplex, residential, R5 to R10, whatever is needed, and then also make sure that they're platted, that they have a lot and block and addition number there, and preferably, you know, no structure on them because of what Mr. Felder said, because clearly you're going to get into asbestos and lead-based paint and other challenges there. Also, the other thing to consider, street condition, water sewer facilities need to be adequate, and those also neighborhood amenities that you talked about, you know, libraries, schools, retail environment, and so forth, because that's going to make those popular. Again, I would just also put out there, if we want to do something like four projects, I didn't see any option that really fit well. But it seems to me the fastest way to build is going to be build something that's already ready to go. The city properties that we have are not ready to go. That's a challenge. But I'd like to see $5 million, you know, per one in each quadrant. Again, break the NIMBYism down, because everybody is distrustful. If you build one project and that's in southern Dallas, then you go, well, there you go again. You're building in southern Dallas. We've already got plenty. Or if you build in Lake Highlands, you know, Mr. McGew has arguably 25,000 units, you know, that's not an area that really has a great deal of demand in our view. Maybe low-hanging fruit with a piece of property, but that's not really where we need those units in my viewpoint. The other thing I would say, Mayor, that this is really an emergency, and I think we ought to strip down every impediment. A lot of cities have really limited regulations in terms of the building day, okay? Dallas is very restrictive. Box Springs, for instance, they built Box Springs Middle School, and they had very little regulation. They just kept beating and banging way into the night. That's how much of an emergency it is. Let's take away those impediments and build at will on these specific projects, and let's get this done.
Thank you. Mr. Clayton.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'll be quick. I think Mr. Callahan kind of echoed what I was going to ask about impediments. So when I was asking earlier about, you know, like Mr. Kingston's example, and then also, you know, the Southern Dallas properties that were mentioned in the magazine. How many properties that the city owns didn't make the cut because either staff said, hey, it can't be done, the zoning's not right. We looked at all the city properties. There were some that just didn't make the cut, right?
That is correct, and the majority of them didn't make the cut for one of two reasons, maybe both. Either they were located in or near floodplain, the actual property rated pretty low in terms of the market value analysis. That stripped out a number of the properties. So many of them were clustered in more of the single family zoned areas and were located in areas that were either marked H or I or so in the MVA. In addition to that, if there was a structure on the property, looking at that structure and the condition of that structure and evaluating potential costs associated with abating some of those issues like asbestos or lead paint would totally exhaust our budget of $20
million. Okay. I didn't realize when I had asked in the first round. I think one thing I would ask that we do is Mr. Atkins had talked about immediacy, and I think if we just did immediate one building, that would solve an immediate problem but wouldn't solve a long-term problem. But I think the one thing we can control that we can factor right now is city-owned properties. The other thing that we can factor and we can control is the use of those city properties. So if something is in a floodplain, we can address that from a policymaking standpoint. Now, if it's 10 feet underwater, well, that's one thing. But if it's we don't build in the floodplain because FEMA doesn't allow us, we can do fill permits and other remediating issues, to fix that. And so I would really say that we, instead of trying to find a solution to something that may or may not be there, we know we can control these properties. And I think we need – I would encourage us to take a closer look and say, hey, here's all the warts on these things. And if we have to do that in executive session, because as I understand, too, we've also had some private interests, but there's concerns about zoning. We can do that in executive session, I think. So maybe, TC, and maybe not. I reserve the right to be wrong. Absolutely. I try to use big words. But I think we really need to address that because I think that's something that I don't want – to lose something because of a political problem. And so I just would really encourage us to go back and do that. I think that's it. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, and thank you for your work. We will adjourn now. I want to tell everyone that we'll be back here at 1 o'clock. Okay, I know that's a short lunch, but we basically didn't do half of the work this morning. It's going to have to be done in the afternoon. I'm going to go ahead and take item C and D first, and then we'll take item B at the end of that. So 1 o'clock, be back here. I'll make sure that we're all set up and ready to go. So we're start. Okay. What did I just say? C? No, I just said just the opposite. We're starting with C and D. Okay. Okay, and then we'll go to B. And so it's a recess at 12:27. So recess. Council, if you can grab your seats, we will reconvene the city council meeting. For Wednesday, May 15th, 2019 at 1:04 p.m. All right, we're jumping all over the place. We were going to, Mr. McGue reminded me as we were leaving that we did not do the inclement weather shelters part of that briefing. We should have kind of done it and taken all the comments. Is she here? She's not here, so we're not going to take that one down, okay? She'll get moved to the end of the day. So we will take up briefing C and D. Mr. Swan, I think you're up. The way we'll do this, so here's what we do. We'll do Mr. Swan, with a presentation on the audit of Visit Dallas, Mr. Zapata, and Rosa will respond. We'll do that. Then we will take up, we'll insert her there, okay? We'll insert her as soon as we do this. We'll take the inclement weather shelters at that point. And then we'll take up item B, which is the consolidated plan. Mr. Broadnecks?
Thank you, Mayor. And these two briefings will cover an audit that was released on Visit Dallas in January 2009. The audit evaluated the effectiveness of services provided by Visit Dallas between 2016 in 2017 by testing performance measures, the usage of hotel occupancy tax, and Dallas Tourism Public Improvement District funds based on three individual contracts. The audit provided 18 recommendations. Two city departments, Convention and Event Services and the Office of Economic Development, provided responses in which they agreed at the time with 11 of the recommendations and provided alternative remedies for the remaining seven recommendations. Without a doubt, there was a historical contract management gap at the city level that impacted the outcomes of these audit recommendations. Staff briefed the Government Performance and Finance Management Committee on February 19th about their strategy for correcting the issues outlined in the audit. The committee asked that staff return in May and provide an update. The presentation that they've prepared today focuses on how we move forward with Visit Dallas as a city, how we correct our lapse in contract compliance, and where we are with development of an amended and restated contract. I've directed staff to have the contract completed before the end of the fiscal year. The newly appointed city auditor, Mr. Swan, is going to do a brief review of the audit recommendations provided earlier in the year, and then staff will cover the corrective action plan. I want to underscore that my expectation is the staff ensure that the work they do for this contract and all contracts citywide is transparent and focused on accountability. Visit Dallas has been a good partner in this effort and has formed a task force and governance committee. We will hear more about that during the presentation. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Mr. Swan.
Welcome, Mr. Swan.
Thank you.
This is it.
All right, good. Good morning, Honorable Mayor Rawlings and distinguished members of the City Council. My name is Mark Swan, your new city auditor.
If we have problems with that. Yeah, just pull it closer to you.
There we go.
There you go. Right. Thanks.
I just want to thank you for the opportunity to serve you and the citizens of Dallas. And my past 2 weeks have been a sponge absorbing all kinds of information. It's been made easier by the talented staff of the office of the city auditor's office, between the auditors and investigators and the support staff. I'm here today to present the results and recommendations for the audit of Visit Dallas that was published in January of this year. And before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the staff contributing to the audit of Visit Dallas. They are Teresa Hampton, who retired earlier this year, and Rory Galter, Eva Narton, and Andrew Yates, who are in the back to help me when you ask questions. The services Visit Dallas provide are important to promote Dallas as a convention and tourist destination. The audit results, however, showed the city to properly oversee and monitor Visit Dallas' use of hotel occupancy tax and the Dallas Tourism Public Improvement District assessment dollars of approximately $29 million annually. The city must develop and follow a more formal contract monitoring process, and Visit Dallas must demonstrate more operational accountability and transparency. Moving to slide two, we'll provide an overview of the primary contracts related to Visit Dallas. The first contract is for the city services contract with Visit Dallas and allocates a portion of the hotel occupancy tax, approximately 30% of the 7% that comes to the city. That comes out to approximately $15.6 million annually. And its purpose is to market the City of Dallas as a major meeting site and visitors designation location and to promote the use of public facilities within the city and a primary emphasis of the K. Bailey Hutchison Convention Center. The Department of Convention and Event Services is the primary responsibility, the proponent of this contract. Also, the Department of Economic Development is responsible for oversight of a small amount for the creative industries portion of this contract. The second contract is the city contract for the Dallas Tourism Public Improvement District and Visit Dallas. This averages approximately $13.5 million annually in funding from the improvement district, and the tourism district was created by the hotel community and is comprised of hotel properties within the city limit with 100 or more rooms. These properties collect an additional 2% on the occupied rooms, which are subject to state and local hotel occupancy tax. This contract provides for special supplemental services for marketing, business recruitment, and promotional activities to increase the hotel stays within the city. The city collects and remits the Dallas Tourism Public Improvement District assessment funds monthly to Visit Dallas, and Visit Dallas administers the funds, makes plan recommendations to the district's board, and expends funds within the approved budget in accordance with the approved plans. The district's annual service plan budget and hotel assessment role ordinance is approved each year by the Dallas City Council. The Office of Economic Development is responsible for this contract, and the city contract specifies the district can only use the assessment funds for certain purposes. The contract also specifies other key requirements, such as preparing an annual update of the service plan to be presented to the City Council for approval and commissioning an annual financial audit of the district's expenses by a certified public accountant. The third contract is for the Dallas Tourism Public Improvement District contract for Visit Dallas, and mainly is contracting for Visit Dallas to administer the day-to-day activities of the Improvement District. Going to slide three, we'll turn to the audit results and recommendations at a very high level. The audit objective was to evaluate the effectiveness of the services provided by Visit Dallas, which included assessing the reliability and reporting performance measures and determining whether the Dallas Tourism Public Improvement District incentive fund and hotel occupancy tax were used for a public purpose and aligned with the requirements for these funds. The audit scope was management's operations during fiscal years 2016 and 2017. The audit started approximately late December 2017, working primarily through 2018, and was published in January of 2019. On slide four, we concluded that as a summary of our audit conclusions, and we concluded the city does not have sufficient mechanisms in place to effectively evaluate services provided by Visit Dallas and needs to improve the Department of Convention and Event Services and the Office of Economic Development's oversight and monitoring of contracts and reporting. And continuing on slide five, the city does not ensure the system of controls over key performance measures for Visit Dallas and the Convention Center allow for consistent and complete and reliable information, and also controls over certain expenses activities are not adequate and may not consistently ensure the city receives the expected benefits. As a result, the city cannot ensure compliance with the hotel occupancy tax and Dallas Tourism Public Improvement District requirements, and the city's ability to adequately evaluate the Visit Dallas's performance may be impaired. And on slide six, presents that during the fiscal years 2014 and 17 for the five-year period, Visit Dallas received approximately $146 million in hotel occupancy tax and Dallas Tourism Public Improvement District funds through these contracts. While the city management agreed that oversight with 11 of the audit recommendations, there was an additional seven that they initially had disagreed, and as we heard earlier, they have come up with alternative methods to address those issues. Due to the dollar amount of the contracts and the initial lengthy implementation time frame, management, the Office of the Auditor encouraged that management to establish an interim milestone dates and report implementation progress periodically to the City Council, which is part of this process. And this concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much. We'll take up the response, Ms. Rosa?
While Joey is making his way out.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right, I'll wait for Mr. Zapata. Okay. Mr. Zapata, excuse me.
Okay. Well, actually, I'll just turn it over to Rosa so she can introduce all the people at the table.
Great, okay. Thank you.
So at the table with me today are our Assistant City Manager, Joey Zapata, Courtney Pogue, who is the Director of Economic Development, Joyce Williams, who is the Chair-elect, she is in the middle, Tony Veda, he's the Chair of the Visit Dallas's newly formed Governance Committee, and Sam Coates, who is the newly appointed Interim President and CEO for Visit Dallas. So as TC indicated, we're here to follow up today on our February 19th briefing. And at the request of the Government Performance and Financial Management Committee, we agreed that in May we would come back and we would provide an update on our progress to date in terms of taking some proactive steps toward resolving the auditor's recommendations. So as a background, the auditor's office released the report in January, and the report reviewed Visit Dallas's performance and our contract compliance of the three contracts that Mark Swan just discussed. So as he said, there were 18 recommendations. We did agree with 11 and provided alternate remedies for seven of those. Now, in terms of the purpose of this briefing, I wanted to underscore that Convention and Event Services and Economic Development, we do recognize that there are historical contract compliance gaps in both our departments as relates to Visit Dallas contracts. However, we do have a continued focus on transparency and accuracy and accountability, and aligned with that, we've looked at the development of methods that improve our contract monitoring. We've worked with Visit Dallas, and we're working internally to engage independent third parties who can help us meet some of the remediation steps that we're taking for this these contracts. And we are working with the city attorney's office toward the execution of an amended and restated contract, and we're trying to do that by the end of this fiscal year. The next slide, we wanted to walk you through a little bit about what our process was in terms of developing our corrective action plan. So we first, immediately after the audit came out, we began to meet with Visit Dallas, and the Visit Dallas board committed to the establishment of two things: a short-term audit governance task force that would help us navigate the process as we came up with a plan of attack to remediate these recommendations and find permanent solutions, and a permanent governance committee. And Tony Veda, later, he can talk more about that and how that developed, how many members it has, and exactly the scope of that committee. We then, Convention and Event Services and Economic Development staff then worked on developing an interim remediation plan. And as we go forward through these slides, we'll show the different dates that we began to meet with Visit Dallas to kind of work towards that. And we're working to memorialize these amendments and this action plan in the amended and restated contract that we discussed. So in the interim, as we go through, we'll show that we're going to test the plan that we put into place, so that we can make sure that it's effective long-term and that the solutions do remediate and fix all of the problems that have been brought forth. The next slide. So since the February 19th briefing to GPFM, we have met consistently with both Visit Dallas staff and the Audit Governance Task Force and the newly formed Governance Committee. And we did that to begin to formulate plans of action that address the audit recommendations. And these meetings resulted in a review of current financial formats and a push to engage third parties to review and to provide feedback on Visit Dallas's existing policies and procedures, some of our internal policies and procedures, and how we ensure that we're aligned with industry standards. So the next slide, I'm going to pass over to Tony Veda, so he can describe the scope of the governance committee and discuss how their meetings between late March and late April allowed them to select some third parties who begin to move towards correcting some of these recommendations.
Thank you, Rosa. I am Tony Veda. I'm president and CEO of the North Texas GLBT Chamber of Commerce, and have been a proud member of the Visit Dallas board for a number of years, and very happily am serving as the governance committee chair, and I reside in District 9. I thought I should mention that. I want to say that the governance audit and governance task force, I think, responded to the audit exactly like everyone here would want them to. They were immediately brought together by our board chair to look at the issues within the audit and begin addressing them. And one of the big things for us was to have an outside company come in and look at policies and procedures, let us know what we have right, where our gaps are. So working with the city, and I should also say, we have been hand in hand with the city. Rose is my new best friend. We brought in three vendors. A couple were suggested by the city, a couple by our board, and provided them with an RFP, letting them know exactly what we were looking for. This is a short-term agreement right now. And we met with each one of them. Our whole committee did, as did the city staff. And answered questions. We provided answers to all the questions to all three companies, and then they submitted their proposals. The proposals were reviewed by the task force as well as by the city, and we came up to it in a unanimous decision on who to pick, and separately, I should say, to a unanimous decision, and we picked BDO USA to do that work.
Corrective Action 1 focuses on improving how we monitor the expenses, how we audit, and how we look at the reporting and invoicing data that we receive from Visit Dallas. Our second corrective action that you'll see in later slides
focuses. We're having a tough time hearing.
Oh, I'm sorry. So I was saying that our next few slides divide the 18 recommendations across three major corrective actions. So this first one focuses on improving how we monitor the expenses, how we look at auditing, how we receive reporting and invoicing data from Visit Dallas. Several slides forward, we'll see corrective action 2, which focuses on how we hire an independent third party to look at our performance goals and metrics. Now, that's a separate third party from the one that that Visit Dallas has already engaged, and that one will be engaged by the City of Dallas. And the third one focuses on the engagement of the third party BDO that Tony just discussed. So if we look at the columns, if we'll go back to that first one, to page 8. If we look at page 8, we'll see that we divided into three columns. So we did, the description is straight out of the recommendations that came from the auditor. Now, you may see R1 repeated across some of these because there were several subsets to that, so we had to divide those across different corrective actions to be effective. The second one, the second column, the frequency, is how often we'll be looking at the data. And the final column is when we anticipate that we'll be done, or if we've already received information towards the sampling and testing. And we wanted to make sure that we were able to confirm that the testing works before we memorialize it completely in an amended and restated contract. So we're going to use the next slide, slide 9. I'm going to turn it over to Courtney, and he's going to talk you through how we'll actually use this corrective action to work through some of the economic development recommendations that came as a result of the DTPID contract.
Thank you, Rosa. Courtney Pogue, Office of Economic Development. Based on the corrective actions number 1, it relates to the items in the Office of Economic Development and the TPID. Some of the items for reconciliation, we have received the bank statements, and we're reviewing those from Visit Dallas, along with making sure that within the corrective action that's a separate bank account for the TPID. Under that, we also have the financial reports, which are provided quarterly to our office, and doing the overall reconciliation will be part of the overall testing of our corrective action going forward. That concludes.
Okay. So slides 11 and 12 have to do with corrective action 2. And one of the reasons that we are seeking to find a third party who can look at the Visit Dallas goals and metrics is to make sure that when we come back to you and then in our future contracts and any negotiations we have going forward, that we can actually demonstrate a return on investment. I know that that's been an ongoing question, so we want to look at what other like-sized cities, what our competitive set are using as goals and metrics, and make sure that we're aligning through those. So I don't want to walk step through each of the recommendations because we've covered those previously, but I do want to jump to slide 13. So on these, we have several. We have recommendation 5, 8, 12, 14, and 16, which all align with the third-party BDO that's been engaged by Visit Dallas. To my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Joyce or Tony, they have already begun work. They're already in the office and starting to look through the actual policies and procedures and look through some of their financials as well to make sure that those policies and procedures, one, align with current industry standards, and two, that they align with how they're practicing business in their office and in their operation currently. And they'll be back and provide an assessment to let us know where we need to look at, what needs to be changed, and what needs to be updated, and kind of give them a path forward. So the next, all of those are covered on the next slides through 15. So we'll go to next steps and focus on that a little bit, because what we'd like to do, I'm working with the city attorney's office right now to provide a draft markup of the existing contract so that it can be evaluated and looked at so that we can get to that amended and restated contract by the end of the fiscal year, by September 30th. And we'd like to, once we do that, come back to council or to the Government Performance and Financial Management Committee and look at that contract and make sure that we've met and addressed our concerns and the concerns that were outlined in the audit. And then, obviously, our next step is renewal options for going forward. So with that, I'd like to open it up to questions.
Thank you. Thank you to the incoming chair, Ms. Williams, for being here. I know you changed some personal plans, and I appreciate it. And welcome to our interim new CEO, Mr. Coates. Is there anything you guys would want to add or say before we take questions?
Mr. Mayor, thank you. And Councilman, thank you.
Put it real close to you. Sorry.
Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for allowing Visit Dallas to be able to come before you today. And just as Rosa has said and spoken very clearly, that we have taken this journey very seriously and taken it where we're hand in hand in a partnership with this. And so, again, just like I said before, we were excited to receive the audit because it gave us an opportunity as a board to look at where we were, how we needed to change, what we needed to change, and how we could do that with our city partners.
Thank you. Anything from you, Ms. Coates? That's fine, if you don't. Okay, good. Mr. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor, and I thank you all for the work that you're doing here. Just full disclosure, I did serve on the board in 95 to 98, so I do have an understanding of basically what the Bureau is really all about, or Visit Dallas. But now with the audit results in, and obviously with the corrective plan that's underway, and with the departure of Mr. Jones, I'm real pleased with the appointment of Mr. Sam Coates, and you know, someone who has really got a great reputation. I think everyone does know and greatly respects Sam as I do, and as someone who has really a high level of broad experience going back many, many years. But we all want more transparency. We've said that. We've asked for that. That's what the audit report has asked for, and we all want better metrics and a cost-efficient structure and a high level of service delivery, and also collect these service gaps that you're talking about. But what, in my viewpoint, that we don't need is to blow up this model, which is currently Visit Dallas. I think that we can resolve these issues. I think we've got the light is shining very brightly on the subject. We know what the challenges are. And, again, I think we can resolve the issues and we can develop a better contract. I think that's first and foremost. You know, it's hard to fault Visit Dallas when they're fulfilling the existing contract is there. But we need to be more aggressive and more challenging and more demanding as a city to make sure that we put into that contract what is expected. And we also, obviously, you know, these are all kind of buzzwords, but we need better metrics and better compliance and accountability and then the contract monitoring. We have a contract, but let's make sure that we monitor the contract, and let's make sure that the city has the necessary resources to provide that monitoring. I think that's really, really important. And we also, I think the outside consultant, I think, was a good pathway to just get them to look a little more so, to peel that onion back and say, is the auditor right? Is this really true? What can we do? What are best practices nationwide? But in my viewpoint, it would be foolish to start over and suggest that the city of Dallas itself, or by going out on a competitive bid process and try to replicate the work that Visit Dallas has been doing and will do in the future. But what we really need is, you know, strong, viable, active, results-oriented Visitors Bureau. But let's just be careful that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater in the process. But again, in finality, a lot of energy and a lot of great work has been done. Let's continue to move the ball until we get it over the goal line, and let's go ahead and get that contract strengthened, and then let's also get it extended. And let's develop a Visitors Bureau that we can all be proud of.
And I really appreciate all of you, and particularly Joyce, you're coming in as chair, and then Sam, just wish you all the best of luck, and I'll be here to assist in any way that I can. Thank you.
Thank you. This briefing's over. We'll take the next item. Is she back? Well, nobody put it up here. Okay. Well, no, it wasn't when I said it.
No, we beat you to it.
No, I said it. Mr. Atkins. Trust me, I said it. Mr. Atkins.
Okay. I just want
to. I thought there'd be some people that wanted to talk. They were all playing. Okay. Mr. Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I guess I want to ask one question, Sam Coates. You up to the challenge of this job? I mean, you do such great work at DFW Board. Since you came aboard, could you just give me the feel, how you feel, what's going on? I know this is an audit came about. I just want to hear from you.
Yeah, this is my third day.
Okay.
I will tell you that we've got a great staff. I'm learning as quickly as I can. It's kind of like drinking from a fire hose. But they're very dedicated. This is an organization that's focused on Dallas. It's not focused on Fort Worth or the region. It's focused on Dallas and bringing destination marketing opportunities to Dallas. And they do it very effectively. I chaired this board 20 years
ago. I know.
And we weren't even second tier. We were maybe tertiary. Today we're number six in the nation. And that accounts for something. So I'm proud to be a part of it. I hope during my short interim time, I can contribute. We're going to get a new CEO. We're going to get a new CFO. And we're going to put those metrics in place that Mr. Callahan referred to and that others have referred to. And we're fiduciaries, and we owe that to the city, and we owe it to the hotel community and the hospitality community.
I just want to thank you for you serving the DFW Board, Mayor. I think it's a good point with Mr. Colt. He'd been around. He was not a stranger. When I saw your name there in the paper, and I said, you're not a stranger to the Visit Dallas Board. Thank you for taking this charge, and thank you for your service.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Thank you. Mr. Felder.
Yes. Thank you for the presentation to everybody on the dais here. Some of the things that I wanted to point out, I don't think we got here by Visit Dallas alone. The city of Dallas did not exact proper oversight over Visit Dallas. I think I said that when you first came to do your presentation. And so I think everybody should take that into account, that the city of Dallas did not do what they were supposed to do. And I think that those controls are getting ready to be put into place. The process has started. My understanding is that two people have resigned, the CEO and the CFO. That's another corrective action. However, I'd like to see further changes. I'd like to see the board pared down. 55 people is way too many. I'd like to see that cut down to about 25. I'd like to see a comprehensive staff review with the number of staff to run Visit Dallas to make sure that we're not overstaffed, and to make sure that the salaries are not excessive for each position that is in existence. Those are the things that come to mind immediately. I do believe that, you know, when we have an opportunity to correct in a situation that is definitely out of line and not functioning the way it should be functioning, when you're dealing with taxpayer dollars, corrective action needs to be taken. And I think you guys have taken several steps, but there's more that needs to be taken. Mr. Coates, I've known you and Joyce for many years, and I respect both of you. And I think that your leadership is going to go a long way. I do not believe that we need to blow this Visit Dallas up and start over. I think that would not be the proper way to go because of the steps that have been taken, and I think there are more steps that need to be taken. So those are my comments today.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The first words we heard in this
briefing were from Mr. Swan when he said the services of Visit Dallas are important for Dallas. On what is that statement based?
Mr. Kingston, would you like me to have a go at that? I'm happy to do so. Mr. Swan?
I'm happy for anyone to answer it, Mr. Coates.
No, and you and I have known each other a long time as well. Thank you for reaching out the other day. I appreciate it. Dallas has a tremendous economic benefit from the tourism meetings and conventions that come here every year. Our hotel community is dependent on it. Our restaurants are dependent on it. You heard Mr. Rathburn this morning. I think you'll hear others. That's why it's important to Dallas. It's important to the economy of the city. People come here. They don't use all our city services. They don't use the police force as much as the fire department. But they spend a lot of money, and they go home. And it also helps put Dallas on the market as a place that is not only a place to visit, but maybe a good place to locate a business.
May I ask you an interim question? I don't mean to interrupt you, Mr. Coates. And seeing you in a leadership role, I think, was an obvious choice for everybody. It gives everybody confidence. We appreciate your service. My ultimate opinion that Visit Dallas has structural problems that you can't fix, I don't mean that to be insulting to you in any way. But I think some of us have very real questions about the statements you just made and about Visit Dallas's ability to prove those.
Yeah.
The city of Houston, for instance, manages to fund its arts at a much more healthy amount than the city of Dallas does, yet is beating the pants off of us in this industry. It is not this constant rah-rah that we're number six and we used to be not even second tier and we're first tier. This is the entity that when we ask what is the economic impact of the Heart of Dallas Bowl, they sent over a press release that said it was $42 million. And when a few of us said, how can that possibly be? We got another press release that said, oops, it was a typo, it was $24 million. And we dug into the actual attendance compared to the $24 million, it would have required something on the order of $2,000 a person in non-duplicative spending. We have gotten misstatements, I think, from Visit Dallas over and over and over again. Who will be funding BDO?
Visit Dallas.
And what will be the source of that funding?
That is a wonderful question that I cannot answer for you, but I will be glad to find out and get back to you all.
Well, I mean, it's going to be majority hotel occupancy tax, correct?
That's possible, but Visit Dallas also has revenues from membership dues. So, again, I cannot give you a definitive answer, and I certainly don't want to lie to you, so I will find out and get back to you all.
My sense is that competitive bidding fixes a lot of things, and if everything that you all have just told us is true, that all these wonderful structural reforms can be implemented and that the city of Dallas will have near-perfect oversight of all this, then it would merely make you all the most strong possible bidder, right? But what we know is that Visit Dallas is an entity that at about $30 million a year chose to pay a CEO over $700,000 a year. In the private sector, a $30 million entity might pay its CEO $200,000. You can tell us that within a matter of months you will go from being an organization that had some severe problems to the perfect organization, but I believe that it is our fiduciary duty to test that against competitive bidding in this market. It is not a call to blow up Visit Dallas. It's a call to give Visit Dallas a chance to earn its services back. And I think that would be a far better use of our time. Hiring an outside entity to tell you how to become a good convention and event services organization rather than simply open this up to market forces, I this is an extraordinary level of contortion to save an entity that by its actions over the past few years has demonstrated that it's not responsible. I get a bit alarmed when I hear hoteliers say that they have to have this. In other places, this stuff is managed better and differently, and it still works. And I don't know why Dallas always has to be the unicorn on everything. So I would very much prefer, Mr. City Manager, that we stick to what the policy of the City of Dallas has been, which is to competitively bid things like this. We've had to bring that in on any number of things, and it can only help with this this effort to clean up what has really been a pretty severely misused pot of money. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Thank you. And no one else does want to speak, so it's over. I want to clarify one thing. I'm probably got some bad information. I thought Dallas was the number one tourist attraction in the state of Texas.
It is. Tourism, and
not
meetings.
Not Houston?
No.
Okay. That's fine. No. All right.
Mayor, one more question.
Thank you.
Yes.
Go ahead real quick.
All right. So the question is,
okay.
I forgot. Hold on, it's there somewhere.
Yeah, senior moment.
Yeah. Oh, when is your contract up? With the city of Dallas?
2020.
So my last comment is the contract is up next year. To start over right now when we're getting ready to review the contract for rebid, I mean, this is an opportunity. Either they perform between now and 2020, or they face the consequences of losing the contract. That's my point. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Nadia, you're up. Thank you, guys.
Mayor, City Council, the Office of Homeless Solutions staff are here to share with you updates regarding the inclement weather shelters. We're coming back based on feedback received from City Council back on April 17th during that briefing to share recommendations to modify and refine our terms as it relates to inclement weather shelters, how we will operationalize that service when those times of inclement weather are triggered. And then recommendations concerning potential amendments to Chapter 51A for the allowance of partners to open up their doors and their facilities to provide shelter service during inclement weather. Monica?
Thank you. We can jump to slide 15. Wanted to very quickly highlight some of the major feedback that we received, and it really resounded around the fact that City Council asked us to take a look at how we would be able to open up temporary inclement weather shelters for all of our partners. Mayor Rollins directed us to come back with specific recommendations related to any revisions to Chapter 51A, and City Council also asked us to define inclement weather and duration timeframes. Slide 16, we wanted to start with our definition of inclement weather, and it is the actual temperature less than 36 degrees and any actual temperature more than 100 degrees during the day with evening temperatures above 80 degrees. For the duration, it would be December 1st through March 1st when temperatures are forecasted to be below 36 degrees, and then from June the 1st through September 1st, when temperatures are forecasted to be above 100 degrees during the day, with evening temperatures above 80 degrees. We've already talked in detail on slide 17, so we're going to skip that and go right to the recommendation on slide 18. City staff recommends an amendment to Chapter 51A, the Dallas Development Code, to establish a temporary inclement weather shelter use. This will allow for inclusion of all interested and qualified operators and vendors and locations. Staff also recommends the creation of a new chapter in the City Code, Inclement Weather Shelter Program. The inclement weather shelter permit would ensure compliance with minimum shelter requirements, fire marshal requirements, health and human service requirements, as well as public safety. And city staff is comprised of the Department of Sustainable Development and Construction, Office of Homeless Solutions, City Manager's Office with assistance from the City Attorney's Office. Slide 19, wanted to talk a little bit about what exactly this new use would include. So again, we mentioned that we'd want to establish an inclement weather shelter as a new lodging use in Chapter 51A. The conditions will include the definition of the use, which we just went over, the definition of inclement weather. It would also discuss the zoning districts where this use would be permitted. So this could either be by right or through an SUP. It would also detail the minimum parking and loading requirements. It would discuss the compliance with the inclement weather shelter program. And then it would also talk about the distance separation between any other inclement weather shelters. With the creation of the new chapter in the city code, the chapter is necessary to give the Office of Homeless Solutions authority through a designation by the city manager to implement, administer, and enforce the temporary inclement weather shelters. Again, I already talked about what the permit would include, but this chapter also talks about the requirements related to the internal layout plan, emergency preparedness, intake and assessment, health, security, and community engagement. It would also include transition and closeout plan. And last but not least, the Office of Homeless Solutions would monitor, evaluate, and assess the program on a biennial basis. Slide 21 has the revised May 2nd Citizen Homelessness Commission recommendation for a request for qualifications. And in their revised recommendation, it states that they would like to issue a request for qualification to identify interested and qualified vendors and operators. They also requested the City Attorney's Office work with CHC and staff to draft an amendment to Chapter 51A to create a temporary inclement weather shelter use. Slide 22, for next steps, what we are asking for you this afternoon is approval to proceed with the CHC recommendation. We are also asking for approval to proceed with city staff recommendation. The Office of Homeless Solutions would work with the City Attorney's Office, the Department of Sustainable Development and Construction, and any others to establish this new main lodging use. And again, these proposed amendments would require approval through ZOAC, CPC, and full City Council approval, and the anticipated timeline is 4 to 6 months once it's placed on ZOAC's agenda. OHS would work with the City Attorney's Office in addition to establish the new City Chapter Inclement Weather Shelter Program. That concludes my presentation. That is correct. Correct.
Thank you. Can you go back just one slide? Okay, so this would be a new main lodging use, is that correct?
Correct.
And as such, can it also be an accessory use?
That would be a question for the City Attorney's Office.
I guess the reason I'm asking is because one of the impetus for this discussion is that we want some of the churches to be able to have this temporary use. Their main use would still be church or institution. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this use would need to be an accessory use, correct? No? Y'all teach me.
Casey Burgess, City Attorney's Office. Could you repeat the question? I kind of missed part of it as I was walking up.
Just trying to make sure that this use, it being a main lodging use, we can still have a separate main use on the same tract of land?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, you can have two uses on a tract.
Got it. Okay. And we'll see more about specific wording in the definition. Other than that, I'm thankful, Mr. Mayor and team, for listening to this and making this recommendation. I think this addresses the issues that we had previously and gives us an opportunity for the people who can do this well to serve those in need during inclement times. So as I understand it, based on what the attorney is, it's a good step, and I appreciate your work on it. Thank you.
Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you for the presentation. The question I had with regards to the inclement weather, so is it, and I know, I guess, when it goes through this whole process, it's going to get more defined out, but what you see happening, is it, would the temporary shelter only be in place during the inclement weather, or could it stay, like if the weather then improved, could it go on for months or weeks, or just when the weather's taking place?
Great question. So yeah. It is when there are actual inclement weather. So we talked about the duration being December 1 through March 1, but it would only be during that time frame when the temperatures were less than 36 degrees. And then when it was warmer,
it would not become a temporary. Okay, so it's not, it doesn't trigger the first time it hits 36, and then it could stay a shelter for the next.
Correct. It's only when it would be below 36 degrees or above 100 with night temperatures above 80.
Okay. So that's your recommendations when you're taking it forward to go through this to ZOAC then.
Correct.
Okay. That's all right. Thank you.
Ms. Callahan.
Yeah. Thank you for the work that you're doing here. I still think we're making this way too hard and way too bureaucratic. I mean, simply, they want an opportunity in these shelter environments, typically shelter environments. They're already providing, you know, services to the homeless. You know, we're basically trying to pick at a scab that's not even there. You know, we've got some of these places have showers, they have food preparation facilities, they have laundry facilities. They're doing everything but a homeless shelter, and they've got some vacant concrete that people are basically just squatting down in the floor with a blanket or sleeping bag and a pillow, and all of a sudden it becomes a crisis, and the city of Dallas needs to hyper-regulate it. I just think that's getting too much government when we really don't need it. All these people do, they're caring hearts. They just want to help people when they need to be helped for a limited period of time. And, again, they're already in the business of providing various services to the homeless anyway, so I was hoping that we would, rather than go to ZOAC and zone out 4 to 6 months, folks. Yeah, we might get this done before winter time comes next. But why wait? I don't know that we're serving any population. What if we have several days like we had a number of years ago where we had 66 days that was over 100 degrees? And bless you. And what if we don't have any regulations in place? You know, what takes place then? This summer is probably not going to be that way. It looks to be on the rainy side with El Nino. But, you know, I always believe in simplification, and I sure don't want to see these nonprofits have to cough up a bunch of fees and go out and get planners and lawyers and wring their hands when all they're really simply trying to do is provide a very necessary need for human dignity. So I don't know how we get there. You know, I know that everyone has their job to do. I'm not so challenged by the, you know, maybe it's making some changes in Chapter 51A, but I just hate to see us go tweaking zoning and doing all those extra things and possibly requiring SUPs. That could just lead to a morass of paperwork and a big, long line of people coming to the city, you know, feeding from the trough. Again, simplify. So I don't know how to get there, but let's make it simple. Thank you.
Mr. Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Just one simple question based on what Councilmember Callahan just said. Is there another way for us to get where we want to go other than the process that's been laid out? Because it sounds like he's saying, you know, hey, you know, this is complicated. It's going to take a extended amount of time. Is there another way to get where we want to go other than this process has been outlined?
So during the April 17th briefing, we went over some other alternatives, and the feedback that we had received at that time is that City Council did not support any of those. So just to kind of refresh you, one of those was that we could pass, City Council could pass a resolution that would declare churches the ability to operate during periods of inclement weather. So there were three different scenarios that we had talked about.
Okay. I want to make sure of that. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your work. We'll take the next item. Mr. Broadnex, why don't you kick us off?
Thank you, Mayor. This particular briefing today is on the HUD's five-year consolidated plan and the fiscal year 2019-2020 annual budget for HUD grant funds. As you will recall, on April 17th, staff briefed you on the new five-year plan and the recommended annual budget. Last Wednesday, Council provided preliminary approval of the plan and budget. At this point in the process, amendments from the City Council members may be considered. As of last Friday, we had received one proposed amendment, which was distributed late Friday, I believe, to the City Council. Today's briefing provides an opportunity to discuss that amendment and conduct any straw voting that is necessary. After today's discussion of City Council amendments, the process requires a public hearing, which is already scheduled for next Wednesday, May 22nd, and then final adoption is scheduled for June 12th. I'll turn the presentation over to Mrs. Raich at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. As the city manager noted, today we'll discuss amendments to the consolidated plan budget. Straw votes will be taken so that we can then incorporate any amendments that receive support into the budget prior to final adoption on June 12th. So that will allow your final vote to include any of the amendments supported today. So as Mr. Broadnex mentioned, the one amendment that we did receive was from Councilmember Magoo. The amendment was to reduce the Overcoming Barriers to Work program from $866,994 to $153,868 and reallocate $713,126 to the Community Courts program. What staff has just handed out, by the way, I know everyone likes to see this. It's complicated to have someone read a bunch of numbers to you. So that should be on the back page of what we just handed out. So as you recall, we committed to fund community courts through the general fund next year so that we could free up federal funds for a new program in partnership with the nonprofit community to address drivers of poverty, specifically barriers to work. The new program was recommended by city management and agreed to by the Community Development Commission after much consideration and based on citizen input. I want to thank the Community Development Commission. I don't know that they get enough thanks from us, and appreciate, of course, all of the folks that you name to serve on that commission. They work very, very hard through this process and consider things very carefully, and I think they took the opportunity this year to tweak what's a really a new approach that that we proposed. So with that, I'll say that we have staff from the Office of Budget, from Community Care, Economic Development, and other departments here to respond to questions. Mr. Mayor, I'll turn things over to you. I'm sure you'll want to facilitate the amendments, perhaps starting with Mr. Magoo.
I know Ms. McGee's got an amendment, but Mr. Griggs hit his light, so I'll let him go first.
Oh, thank you, Mayor. Just a general question, if this is available. We've talked about this before, about geography mattering with this, and in particular, how much of these funds do we think are targeted towards the concentrated areas of poverty, particularly the recaps, the 36 or so recaps we have in the city of Dallas?
The plan is for the public improvement dollars, so that would be the dollar amount that's on line C-10. So this right now it's $2.3 million. for those public improvements in recap areas.
So of all these other funds, which any of the other funds do we think are going to hit recap areas?
They're primarily based on first come, first serve, based on eligibility. So residents from those recap areas may be eligible for those, but they are not specifically targeted to recap areas.
Then, in general, I think it'd be good to prioritize these funds for recap areas. As you know, since the year 2000, our recaps have grown dramatically from 18 to doubling now to 36. The concentrated areas of poverty are a huge deal. Now it's over 40 square miles of the city of Dallas is in a recap. So prioritizing these funds for recap areas to lift those areas out of poverty is critically important. So that's I hope that becomes a factor in deciding how we're going to award these funds. I know we only have $2.3 million or so of these funds directed right now to recaps. But with the programs and so much of these programs can help people get out of poverty, and to see those funds being made available for recaps would be very important. I think this goes back to that map we had from the University of Texas at Arlington that showed all of our recap areas and it showed all of our city programs on our expenditures. And there's a giant area of recaps. And then all around the recap areas where we were spending the money, we're not spending sufficient funds in the recaps to turn them around. So that's a general comment I'd like to see on how the plan is implemented, that we get all these dollars into recaps. That's really where the money is needed to start turning those areas around. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Mr. McGue.
I'm not sure if I'm officially supposed to, but I'll read the prepared motion that regards the amendment that I proposed. It says, I move to amend the proposed community development block grant budget to reduce the overcoming barriers to work line CD05 by $713,126 and increase restore funding for the community courts program line CD04 by $713,126. And in a discussion I had at one point in time with Ms. Raich as well, by doing this, this doesn't mean we can't include that same funding in the general fund to for the city manager's proposal. So you're just basically taking it from general fund to CDBG to fund community court and still allow that funding through the general fund discussion process. So that's my amendment.
Thank you. We have posted a straw vote on this issue, so we can kind of take that. So with that, is there anyone that would straw second it? Okay. Got it. So that's something we'll talk about. You want to say anything else, Mr. McGue, before we?
Not really. I think okay. We've had this discussion for a while now, and it's the same arguments, and I just want to continue to support the community courts.
Thank you, Mr. Clayton.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Last week when we made the motion, or when Mr. McGue made the motion, I'd asked on this, so this is for the consolidated plan. So if we do this motion, is it a one-year decision or a five-year decision?
This is a one-year decision in that this is a one-year budget. However, and where we erred last week in our response to your question was that we went back and looked, and it does have an effect on the five-year strategic plan, on the five-year plan that we are completing. In that plan, we had originally laid out the strategy and the concept that for this particular pot of money, and Shan, correct me if I'm wrong, it would be about 50-50 between existing programs in the city and this new nonprofit focus for community groups to focus on overcoming the barriers to work and addressing poverty. And so we would need to go back and amend that strategy to take out that numerical split. And Shan can give the numbers. I don't want to give them because I might be wrong as to what this split would now be. But go ahead.
Yeah, let me just ask, because Barriers to Work is not like Barriers to Work LLC. It's just that's how we're labeling it to
right.
If it's an aftercare program or name your issue.
It could be any number of supportive services in terms of job training or other supports to enable people to be prepared to interview for a job, go for a job, get the job, and then be in the job, meaning even child care or some other things are potentials.
Gotcha. I guess here's where my concern is. I may want to ask Ms. McGee a question.
Please.
If I can. My concern is if the consolidated plan, if the design of it is to give us money to be able to use in our communities, you know, to empower folks who need to be lifted up, and the great majority of that's for housing, this is basically our checking account. And so if we do the motion, then effectively everything that we say for the drivers of poverty and everything that we say we're going to do to empower people to be lifted out of that, we're erasing in favor of community courts. I guess, Mr. McGee, if you don't mind me asking, why, and I know you've had the conversation, you live it, so just forgive me for not knowing the answer. Why do you want to take it out of the general fund and put it into CDBG when it's already being funded?
Well, it's been funded through CDBG. It's been funded through CDBG. To Mr. Griggs' point, the community courts is what serves these recap areas. The community courts is what does exactly what you're talking about as far as empowering people out of the poverty conditions and through a successful program gets them into advanced training and out of drug programs and into the functioning society. And it's doing exactly what we're saying we want it to do. The question is, do we want to take that service who, with all these federal funds, it's a lot of audit, analysis, record keeping, all these components that our community court has proven to do extremely well with perfect reports for the entire years of the program. And that's a lot of work. People don't realize how much it takes to do that. I would much rather have the programs that are coming up that we're looking at as a council not have all those requirements and put our funding, our federal funding at risk in those programs. If it's something that our council wants to support, we should fund it out of the general fund. We should put whatever categories or criteria we want on it for reporting and give them those programs the best chance to use the funding to make it work, as opposed to tying them to the and put our funding at risk.
Okay, thank you. I guess what my concern is, and again, I'm not being snarky, I just don't know. I see community courts, it's I get a bulk trash violation, I go to community courts. You know, that's what I sometimes sense of what it is. So when it's, if you are a person that's really in need, what is an example of something that community courts does that will lift somebody out of poverty? I just don't know. And the reason I ask the question, my concern is, I won't be here, but the world's about to change because of what the legislature's doing. And so there's not going to be money to fund what we do now. So effectively, what we're telling the feds we're going to do, I don't know if we're going to be able to do, because we're basically getting rid of any kind of discretionary spending for people in poverty. So we'll talk it, but we won't do it. But yet we'll have community courts. And my concern is, should community courts, purpose of it, good, bad, indifferent, does that trump what we should be doing with some of these programs we might be able to access? And that's what I guess I'm struggling with.
Yeah, I guess the last time this came up and the timing of when these briefings come, they had several of the graduates that were here. It's absolutely not just you get a bulk trash ticket. These are folks that have had 62 tickets for a pedestrian in a roadway drinking in public that have been a weight on our system and that are now going through and for the first time graduating a program, getting their records cleaned, getting a fresh start at getting a job, getting an placement, and the actual hardest work of getting someone out of poverty is what our community courts are doing every single day.
Well, I know we're just doing straw votes, so maybe if we can kind of sit down offline about this, I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to call out that we have Angelica Portillo's in the audience today, and she's the project manager for After the Bell Alliance, and I know their group advocated for about $300,000 for after-school programs. That's something that's been near and dear to me. I was actually a coordinator back in college doing this type of thing during summer park playgrounds, and I think this is very important. You know, we have a lot of latchkey kids and working parents and challenges, but I really appreciate the work that they've done, so I just wanted to call attention to that. So I'm going to read something real quick. This says, Dear Councilmember Callahan, thank you for your support you've shown after school and summer programming. You may recall the Dallas After School Big Thought and Early Matters Dallas presented to the Community Development Commission meeting in March. We advocated for additional CDBG funds to be allocated to the park and recreation out of school time programs, programs and child care. Not only were we successful in getting 300,000 approved by the commission, but they also reported 42% of the public comments mentioned the need for additional support for youth services. So as you consider the preliminary adoption of the fiscal year 2019-20 HUD consolidated plan budget, please know that the Dallas After School and our partners listed above support the proposed budget. So, and from Dallas After School, our partners and the children they serve, thank you. So shows that when you get involved and you advocate, you get things done. But this, again, is a great need that we have in our city for these kind of programs after school, during the school year, but also during the summer season as well. So thank you all very much. And I want to just throw a shout-out to Elizabeth Caudill, my Community Development Commission member. She's highly regarded and does a great job. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mayor. And Ms. Vergu, I mean, I'm a big supporter of community courts. I know we are actually opening, you know, we have temporary space right now for the community courts in our area, and we're opening the new center, which will be in Vickery Meadows. So I'm supportive of it. I just had a question for the city manager. With regards, I mean, you're working on the budget for next year. So are you, this amount of money that you're decreasing from community courts, I guess this is for you as well as the city attorney's office because they create their budget, are you planning on replacing all those dollars in the general fund? Should I ask Mr. Queso that? Because that's part of his budget. Is that correct? Because there's still some money in this budget for community courts. But.
Senator is including that in the budget to replace those funds in the city attorney's budget.
But I guess there's a concern that it couldn't stay there later if it was, I mean.
Right. I mean, the deal is once the funds get taken out of CDBG, we can't go back, right? Because the federal government would say, oh, you can use general funds, so you don't need
to. But we as a council, if we value community courts, we're going to continue to put it in the general budget.
Every year. What we would hope, if that's what is the vote of the council.
So, Mr. McGoo raises a good point regarding kind of the hurdles regarding, I guess, the paperwork associated with qualifying for CDBG funds. So if we actually remove them from this, the oversight, I mean, I think that's great oversight, especially when it's nonprofits we're partnering with, that they have to fill that out and meet that criteria. But this is a program that we're administering and we're managing it, the community courts. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, we've been doing it for almost 15 years where we've been, you know, we do the grants, we monitor it, we do all that work.
So it'd be less work on the city if they were not having to do because if you're just getting it in general fund dollars and not CBDG dollars, you wouldn't have to do that.
If we got it in general fund dollars, we wouldn't need to do, you know, the same type of work. But we obviously would do some of the same things. Some of the same things to track it and do reports and things of that sort to show to the council, okay, this is what we're doing. It's not reporting it to the feds under the grant, but we would still.
But I think that's necessary reporting that would have to come to us. So, but it would be not required to go to the federal government. So, I think we need to prioritize it. I understand where the commission's coming from. If we have the commitment from city attorney's office and our manager that it's going to continue, because I think it's extremely valuable. Their work goes beyond just, you know, taking care of a community work, taking care of a ticket, because there's like wraparound services that are incorporated. So, but I could, as long as, you know, I could approve this as long as I know it's going to continue to be funded.
Mr. Atkins.
You know, I've been around a long time, and community court have been a great service. It is trying to address Mr. Clayton. If you come to my community office and you see how the community court actually work, actually bring people out of poverty to give them a new life, relief in life, and be a character, it also be a respect. It'd be honest, they go out and meet the citizen and talk to them. If we're going to bring people out of poverty and bring them back to society, this is the tool we've been using. And I just wish that we put a community court in my district. I mean, just had that court present there. I talked to the DA, Crusoe, you know,
We need that issue. And I think that they had did a great job. I mean, why should we change something? You know, we always change and we feel a department been broken. But this has not been broken. It's been doing a great job. There's no negative out there. So it's since not a negative out there, why should we change it? So I appreciate Ms. Magoo, you know, really looking into it. It's something that he'd been a part of, you know, when he was part of the attorney office. It's someone that the community had respect. If you went to the ninth anniversary of the community court over there at Dark Rail Line, you will see that it's something we need in the Southern States. I think we should stay this way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Mr. Callahan?
Yeah, just quickly, second round, Chris mentioned that this program been in place for 15 years, but just want to add the fact that there's not one in Southeast Dallas, not one in Pleasant Grove. I mentioned that. I didn't hit the urgent button, but I said over the next year or two we'd like to see that. And Mr. Atkins said that he would like to have one in his district. So we could maybe just put it near the district line of 5 and 8 down there somewhere, you know. I don't care which side of the road it's on. As long as we have one easily accessible, we shouldn't have to go to MLK to access these kind of services. So hopefully we can do that.
Mr. Brodnick?
Thank you, Council Members. I think, in part, I think we've had this discussion probably the last 3-4 months, and I know I've had quite a few conversations with Council Member Magoo about it, but I think the desire that I'm hearing beyond this issue, whether from you or Councilman Atkins and others who've expressed an interest in having additional community court services, I just have to ponder the question, if in fact we added those services, they would come from the general fund. And over 50% of the funds that support community courts today come from the general fund. And so any increase in services related to that would come from the general fund. And so, again, that's my entire point about it's a 15-year-old program that we have, I guess, incorporated as a part of what we do around restorative justice, that I do not see this council and or city managers and or city attorneys trying to abandon our efforts there. While I think, as I've said before, when I first was introduced to the Community Development Commission, one of their first statements to me was, can you find a way to identify more flexibility and more access to the CDBG funds that we're supposed to govern and remove them from actually continually being spent inside City Hall? And so I was just trying to be responsive to the commission and the people you appoint and some of the former council members that were on the council when I first started about the opportunities to ensure that we were able to leverage and allow for the growth and capacity building of many of our nonprofits in the community. So, again, at this point, it's a council decision, and we're going to support and continue to do community courts, whether it's in CDBG or in the general fund. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak. Thank you.
Q, Mr. Atkins, did you want to talk again? Okay. Ms. Arnold.
Excuse me. Okay. Thank you so much just for the quick comments. Because the community court is in District 4, and I'm just happy that previous councils found it important enough to the constituency and to our delivery to put it in District 4. But I can tell you we're very pleased with the performance and the leadership, and it would be great, of course, for other districts to be able to use that from this model in District 4. So, but I want to continue to support Councilman Magoo and applaud him for his advocacy, is also with Ms. Diane Gibson with her leadership and commitment to the court. So just wanted to put that out there and just know, too, that while we are pondering the addition in other districts, we are on a DART rail line, so you can get there. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Magoo.
So just kind of one last point is, I have lived through the community court when we had very tough budget years and when there were times to cut. And the community courts are not chartered courts. They're not protected in any other way other than what happens around here. And it becomes one of the easiest things to cut. And that is the problem with this. I would much rather look at a program that we were just looking at creating to say, hey, we don't need to do that program, versus cutting the portion that is still funded through CDBG that protects the courts. through this. And without that, I've just simply, we would not have community courts right now if it weren't for the CDBG funding. And we probably wouldn't have a community prosecution back in 2005, 2007, 2008, if it weren't for the CDBG funding.
Thank you. Mr. Kingston?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. All of this, I'm sure you're hearing this, Mr. Broadnax, unless I'm completely wrong about how people feel about this, I don't think there's anybody on the council who doesn't fully support community courts and community prosecution. I've heard some council members have more and less complaints about their specific community prosecutors, but I think the program is incredibly well supported. And so I really have strong respect for Mr. McHugh's experience because that did happen. There were cuts. I am not convinced that that would happen again in another downturn. And in part, it's because of the work of Mr. McHugh and the community prosecutors that have shown themselves to be so indispensable. I don't really foresee that being on the chopping block. I know that, you know, part of the issue was we had an unprecedented downturn. And then the second part of the issue is the council at that time made, in my opinion, some strategic errors in the way that it tried to manage the budget in response to the downturn. And so I just don't foresee that moving the funding for community courts into the general fund is nearly the existential threat that it was back then and that Mr. McHugh is warning us about now. And so I would be looking for management to provide a greater level of assurance to Mr. McHugh and to the rest of us that moving this to the general fund does not endanger the services. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Clayton.
Thank you. Just very quickly, you know, where I wanted to see this thing goes is I think I tend to defer to my friend Mr. McHugh as far as it goes to community courts as well because, like I say, I don't live it, I don't see it, I haven't done it. And so and that's why I want to make sure that we talk offline to get to a better place on it. I just still have my concerns that I believe in my heart of hearts that the consolidated plan is our vision and our affirmative definition of who we care for and why. But I know that the ship is sinking with our legislature, and I worry that we are what we value and what we fund, and I don't want to be shifting jobs programs between the general and the CDBG money to make sure that we protect one program or the other. Every program should be accountable, whether new or used. My challenge, and that's when Mr. McHugh and I kind of sit down, you know, offline, if where I struggle is even doing that presentation, we're going the wrong direction on poverty. The data shows it. And so every program needs to be able to say from a metric, this is what we're doing different and better. And I did not get that out of that briefing, and that's where I struggle with this. But again, you've lived it as a CP, so I don't know what you see. So that's why I want to sit down. So I don't want to say I don't love community courts. I'm kind of agnostic to them, frankly. But I do generally believe they should be in the general fund, one, to Mr. King's point, two, because I think it's something that the first thing that's going to get cut is the social program. When the bottom hits, that's going to get cut because they can't speak up. And so that's my objection to it right now, but knowing that we're just doing straw votes today. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. First of all, a clarification question to you, Mr. McHugh. Are you making this motion and also in that motion instructing the city manager to take all these things that are in the plan and put them in the general budget?
I think that's at the discretion of the city manager, but if that's what, yes.
Okay. Is that what Mr. Atkins is second? Okay. So I just want to be clear what you were talking about that. I'm with Mr. Clayton. And one of the things I'm pleased about this council is we've gotten serious, at least in talking about poverty. You know, there's a lot of things we get up close to and we don't quite get over the line, but at least we're taking this issue very seriously. Our Child Poverty Action Lab has
has isolated one of the most important issues that this council has talked about is the criminal justice system and how many people are thrown into that. And I know for a fact, and that is a driver of poverty, and I know for a fact the community courts is a major, major stopgap from that happening. And so I have been a proponent of the community courts and think they do a remarkable job. But here is the buts. You're right, Mr. Clayton. We're going to have less money as a city coming out of this, and some tough decisions are going to be made. The good news is I count ahead. I know that at least eight of you are going to still be here for that budget discussion. And the question is, can you eight, you know, promise that these programs will be spent in that budget and you're going to cut something else? Or can you eight say we're going to have the money for criminal courts? And so I kind of understand what Mr. McGue is saying. He's going like, I'd like to believe that's going to happen, but I'll take what I know works and make sure that gets paid for. And in the era of let's make sure we've got something that works as opposed before we go something else, you know, I think his logic is a pretty interesting logic. It would really be sad if we took these programs and we didn't spend money against them. And I also agree with Mr. Griggs that they need to be in high-impact areas, okay? We don't need these in other places. And however we do those, implement those contracts. And so, you know, it's for a few of us that aren't going to be here, it's easy for us to make a call, but the real tough decision is going to be made by you guys. But I'm hearing either way, Mr. Broadnex has said, I'm going to put community courts in the budget if you guys don't cut it. And Mr. McGue just made a motion that all these things will be in the budget and we'll lock CBDG down. So I don't think we disagree. It's more of a what do you need to be certain about? So that's the way I kind of look at this. So we'll take a straw vote on Mr. McGue's motion first. All in favor of that, show of hands. That. Is that it, Ms. Reich?
Unless there are other amendments. We did not receive any ahead of time, but.
Okay. Good. Ms. Johnson, do we have any speakers? Oh, there she is. Just messed up.
Good afternoon. We have three remaining open microphone speakers. Mary Stamm, not present. Maria Mendez, not present. Cheryl Spivey. Ms. Spivey, you may come forward. I'll recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of the City Council. Yes. Any speaker making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks, or who becomes boisterous while addressing the City Council shall be removed from the room. You'll be given 3 minutes to speak. You notice the time at the monitor in front of you. When your time is up, please stop. Address your comments to Mayor Rawlins only. If you have any handouts, you may want to go ahead and hand it to the officer to my right. You may begin.
Mayor, I would like to thank
you. I need you by the mic. There we go.
Yes, sir.
There you go.
My name is Cheryl Spivey, and I want to thank you, Mayor Rawlins, for the time that I was in the housing program when you got me started. I grew up in the military, and I had never heard of outside housing. The only housing I'd ever heard of was base housing. So before you leave, I wanted you to know that and to thank you very much. Apparently, I came at the right time to talk about housing and different things that concern poverty-level people. In this city, you all see these people walking around that are severely mentally ill, and they're in the street. There is one in particular, a woman, at the West End station. She has a barrel that she keeps all of her things in. She's across the street from the McDonald's, right there at the train station. She's been there for several years. I've called some churches. I've called some other people that I thought would possibly be able to help her. And that lady is still there as of today. I saw her today. So I don't know how your budget works and what you all plan to do about these people. But just like when I got here today, the SPCA was right outside the door. And I don't know if you have a van that says, we help people that can't help themselves, that you drive by and assist these people. Because my thing is this, in this city, because you have a lot going on here, this is a lovely city. But I think when people come here to bring their businesses here, and they see these people that are abjectly homeless and destitute in the streets day in and day out, year in and year out, I think it affects them as to whether or not they will bring their businesses here. And I just want people to be able to put a stop to this. It doesn't make any sense for the city to be operating as well as it does in so many areas and to leave people out there like that. So that's basically what I wanted to say. And thank you again.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
No further speakers, Mr. Mayor.
Meeting's adjourned at 2:32 p.m. Thank you.